call the House Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Welcome this morning to everyone. Thank you for being here. And the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. Do I have someone that would like to move? Representative Zerwas would like to move the minutes of February 5th, 2015. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. The minutes are adopted. The next item on the agenda, we're going to do some panel discussion this morning on license plate readers and body cams. And because there are a few testifiers that have to leave at certain times, we're going to start with body cams. License plate readers, my bad. We're going to start with the license plate readers. So if the testifiers that are on that issue would like to come forward. The agenda here this morning is we're going to allow about 8 minutes per person to give their testimony, and then we'll open it up to members for questions. And so go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, and go ahead and start with your testimony, Mr. Potts.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Potts. I'm the police chief for the city of Bloomington. And for my presentation here, I was just going to try to provide just a little, a few slides by way of PowerPoint to show you what LPR is, and maybe describe the technology just a little bit so that we all have kind of the same understanding of what it is. So I'll kind of start off with the slides. First, what LPR is not, it is not a video recorder. It is not a tracking device. It's not networked across jurisdictional lines. It does not capture every Minnesotan's plate. From a number standpoint, the use of LPR is quite limited in Minnesota. This slide kind of illustrates that. About 17% of Minnesota police departments currently have LPR. That is as recent as is just a couple months ago. Why LPRs are valuable? Because what they do is they automate what police officers have done for many years, which is their ability to run license plates. It's not done manually, it's done automatically through the system. It allows officers to be more efficient and less distracted while they're driving around in their squad cars. How it works, typically it's mounted on a squad car, can be mounted stationary, but in Minnesota most of the LPR systems are used in a mobile fashion, attached to a squad car, automated high-speed camera and optical character recognition. They work with on the squad cars at speeds of up to 80 miles an hour, closing speed of 160. So if there's a car coming at them, the speeds have to be no more than 160, squad car speed of no more than 80, and the system can capture license plate. Basically what it does is it takes a snapshot of a license plate and records that license plate at a date, time, and at a location. How it works is it scans those plates that it captures against a hot list in real time. Those hot lists consist of a stolen vehicle file, a missing persons file, which includes Amber Alerts, things like that, warrants, terrorist hot lists, and a few others managed by the state of Minnesota. In those vehicles that are in the hot list, that's called when the license plate matches that, that's a hit, and officers are able to take immediate action on those hits. Hit data versus read data. This sometimes I think is a little bit confusing. The hits are those license plates that are in the hot list, in the database, and then there are the reads. The read is otherwise known maybe as a scan. Some people refer to it, I think, as a non-hit, but it is the picture of the license plate at a date and at a time. Here in Minnesota, those, depending on the agency, are stored on a server anywhere from 48 hours to 90 days. The value of that read data expands the investigative capability of the agency, identifies possible suspects, it rules out innocent people, provides evidence to bolster prosecutions. We have an example here. I have told this story a few times. This is the value of read data in a case in Bloomington. A while back, from using mobile LPR, we had 14 incidents where a person was throwing things out of a window of his car, driving down Normandale Boulevard. Those objects were hitting oncoming cars in the grill. They were embedded in the radiator. He started with small fairly lightweight object, such as a bottle of water, just a small bottle. He progressed up to gallon-sized jug of water, and ultimately one of the final incidents was this steel vise you can see in the picture here. As you can imagine, at a closing speed of probably 90 or 100 miles an hour, that coming through your windshield can be quite devastating. In fact, it penetrated the windshield, hit the steering wheel, and hit him in the jaw. Broke several bones, took out many teeth. And with the use of LPR data, we were able to solve that case. We were able to get a conviction for first-degree assault. The data that we use in that case to arrest the suspect, who's the picture, the photographed person there, was 64-day-old data. It speaks to the value of data that is stored, LPR data that is stored. There are a lot of other examples of crimes that are reported well after the fact. This slide just shows you kind of from four agencies that we were able to collect data from. Speaking to Bloomington, we had in 2014 212. Now, part one crime is considered serious crime. Part one crime that was reported 212 days after the crime was committed. These are potentially cases where LPR and the data that is stored may be helpful in solving. And you can see the data from St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth. Safeguards for LPR, that is safeguards for the data. Restricted access agencies would be required to have restrictions on who can access that data. Public audits of the queries, just like many other databases, these systems all come with electronic querying and electronic tracking of who accesses the database. And so doing audits is actually quite easy, and you can find out exactly who is accessing the data and for what reason they would be accessing the data. There's a required field for entering a case number, a reason for that query into the database. And then the requirement of written policies and training regarding the access of the data. And I guess what, you know, just to wrap up my portion here, we do really want to, you know, strike the balance here of the use of good technology. We know that there's technology out there that is very helpful to law enforcement in terms of keeping our community safe, solving crimes, but also balancing that against, you know, individual privacy rights. And so really that's what we're trying to strike a balance. What we're trying to do is strike that appropriate balance so that we don't end up losing the use of what we think is some really good technology that helps us solve cases, not only in Bloomington. Colleagues back here could talk about examples in their jurisdictions. I think our community expects us, really, in these investigations to turn over every stone to try and solve them, and even prevent them on the front end. And we feel, I personally feel, I think our group set feels, that to not be able to retain that data would be really not being able to turn over a really important stone in our efforts to try and solve some of these cases.
Thank you, Mr. Potts. Mr. Neumeister, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to make some comments. And again, if Alex will let me know in 8 minutes so I can then wrap up within the other 2 minutes that I have. One of the handouts I gave to you is a color picture, courtesy of Mr. Mike Castle-Cabe. These are pictures of what LPR pictures look like, other than the plate. Secondly, you see a diagram there saying if you a year in the life of an ordinary person with a year's worth of ALPR scans that are kept. Whether or not it be 90 days or not, I have no idea. There's some 30-plus agencies that have license plate readers in the state of Minnesota. Some may have 90 days. Some may have 48 hours like the State Patrol. It could be maybe more than 90 days. But the bottom line here is that this is no Rube Goldberg contraption. This is basically a simple thing where a camera sees something, sends back information matched with the database, and then sends it back. It's that simple. It seems simple, but it has a lot of impact on our privacy and civil liberty rights. Now, one of the things that, other than just collecting the record, time, the date, and location, takes a picture of the plate. It also, the car and area around it. And as you look on with the packet that I have, and this is going to be the essence of my presentation, is the packet that I gave to you. In 2010, I started reading newspaper articles It was basically from a fluff kind of piece. Hey, we got this new technology going after stolen cars. But I didn't really see anything about privacy. Or I heard a little mention, oh, Big Brother's watching. But none of the impact on the issue of surveillance. This is a surveillance tool and some of the implications of it. Since 2010, I have done many, many data requests from Duluth, Rochester, Washington County, Ramsey County, Roseville, Hastings, Lakeville, St. Paul, Hennepin County, Minneapolis, Maplewood, Olmsted County, all who have license plate readers. And there might be a couple others thrown in there that I've missed. So what happened? I started writing about this. And then what happened? A reporter picked up on some of the blog writing and tweets that I was doing. And you have a story that's in front of you that appeared 3 years ago. Now, the bottom line here is that we're keeping millions of records at one time or another on innocent and law-abiding Minnesotans. And so that's the nub of some of this. Now, to give you an example from this newspaper article, approximately at the end on page 2, you'll see 6,100 were hits out of 805,000 reads. That's 0.75%.
Mr. Neumeister, could you point out which article you're referring to, please?
The first one, August 10th, on page 22.
Oh, okay. My bad.
And that's constant. I've constantly asked for what the reads are, how many versus hits. It's either basically 1% or less, on average about 0.5%. Now, the issue is that you'll hear in some of the debate, and that's, again, an informational point, is that a plate is in the public venue. So therefore, there's no privacy or liberty interest. I think with enough knowledge that you've heard about this issue, there are liberty and privacy interests, particularly with the use of the technology and the centralizing of information. So you'll see, like, for example, how, and an example of Minneapolis pictures on page 3, you'll see pictures of how their camera worked. Got to remember, there are a number of vendors pushing this product, 3M, Virtual Solutions, and another one I'll give you an example of down the line. Now, on page 5 and 6, how the proliferation of all this information came about was three ways. One is a local entity, jurisdiction will buy the product. Secondly, Homeland Security monies. The third way is through the Department of Commerce, which you have an example of the contract. How a lot of these were done was through a stolen car program. In other words, hey, we got some nice equipment, use it to capture stolen cars. In the data that I've looked at and all that, there was no mention of surveillance, using it for other kinds of purposes or whatever. It was basically primarily for stolen cars. Now, in my data request, on page 7 through page 12, and I have all these documents if any of you are interested, this gives you what one provider gives. This is from the city of Maplewood. I got about 6 or 7 handbooks how to use equipment from 3M, LSAG, whatever. And if you look on page 9, you'll see some of the technical things, the speed, some of the things that Chief Potts talked about. On page 10, you'll look at some of the things that the vendors recognize that should be used for, watch list development, pattern recognition. It's more than just catching stolen cars. And this varies throughout the country. Another example, if you look on page 13, you'll see this is what you will get. Again, pictures. I have hundreds of pictures. I'm in the process of getting some of the pictures that are just more than the plate from Minnesotans who are doing a data request. And to show you again, it's more than just the plate. It's around the area, and the technology is moving fast. On page 14 and 15 and 16, again, I've gotten a dozen of these. These are the sheets that on a data request where you want to see how many hits. These are from Bloomington. These are from Minneapolis. I've gotten them from other areas. Again, it's sort of like always less than 1%. Guidelines on page 17, you'll see where it's a very broad kind of thing. This is basically a marketer's language. A lot of the agencies have these, how broad it is. For a data request, found out that the Mall of America had 12 LPRs, collecting millions of records on people, along with the photos. Now, within the Bloomington Police Department, there's a different point of view. In the contract that I saw with Bloomington, at least the Mall of America got the license plate and a picture of the car. There's a difference of opinion on that, and Chief Potts has publicly said that's not the case, but at least I wanted to share that with you. You'll see another map of Ryback's places where he went in Minneapolis. Now, the next two pages, through 22 through 29, are a PowerPoint that gets into detail about how the new line of LPR products are going to be about facial recognition integration, other kinds of integration with other kinds of public databases. But on page 27, I share with you another new innovation that's coming out, handheld, where you take a picture of a camera and it provides the same way as what a license plate reader does. Again, on page 3029, it goes in detail. It says no personal information, but there is personal information. On page 30 and 31, this is the state database that it's paired up to. Locals also have their own local databases. Now, there's been issues of where sharing goes. The next few pages are articles across the country where this data is being centralized in states, being shared with the federal government through fusion centers. Also, the articles talk about the new technology and then ends up with the most recent articles from the Wall Street Journal about First Amendment, where they're doing things at First Amendment activities. So there are a number of articles in a broad way that's trying to give you some as full, complete information.
Questions from members? Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chief Potts, you would say that only 70% of Minnesota police departments use LPRs.
Thank you. So, can you tell me, I mean, I'm assuming that we're not talking about 17% of the population is either looked at or benefits from these. Which are these the larger jurisdictions in the state?
Mr. Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I think the number is about 24 agencies, if I'm not mistaken, from our research collected here just a couple months ago. I can tell you that I know Bloomington is using it. I know that both Minneapolis and St. Paul. I don't know who the remaining 21 agencies are. I would hazard a guess that it probably is some of the larger, but I'm not sure on that. I think most of them have been obtained through grant dollars, and those who are participating in auto theft prevention, I think that's probably the most common funding source for these systems. But I don't know the makeup of the agencies.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chief Potts, you had stated at the beginning of your testimony that this is not a tracking device and it's not networked across jurisdictional boundaries. So what's your response to Mr. Neumeister's? I didn't read all the articles that he stated he has in here regarding the desire to network these across jurisdictional boundaries. Is it your intention that your agency never participate in any kind of fusion center or effort to network these across jurisdictional boundaries? Is that what you meant by your testimony?
Mr. Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm just simply saying it's not a tracking device, and currently we are not networking it across jurisdictions. I think what Mr. Neumeister points out is there's potential there. However, we're not doing that right now. And I think, you know, depending on how these discussions go, there may be limitations on that. I don't know what the future holds in terms of that. I do think that the capabilities are there. However, speaking for the city of Bloomington and what I know about the other cities, it's not being done right now.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Lesch.
Chief Potts, do you want to do that?
Mr. Potts.
I guess my interest is using the technology in a way that we're going to be able to you know, locate suspects who've committed crimes. If that technology exists and it's within the parameters of the law, I mean, we're about trying to protect our citizens. And if that technology allows for it, if the law allows for it, then I think that's the direction we would go at some point. Right now, we're not doing that, and I think we need to complete these discussions before we advance that discussion.
And then one last question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Chief Potts, has your agency complied with state law with respect to the use of this data vis-a-vis the Safe at Home program in Minnesota?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, to the best of my knowledge, we've complied with the state law.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, I was dealing with this lovely stuff again. Madam Chair, Chief Potts, Thursday night I ran into my sheriff in Isani County and learned that they had just received and installed the LPR that week through a grant process through Mille Lacs County. So there's two different jurisdictions that now have them. Last night I was talking with the officer whose squad has been mounted on, which happens to be my old squad car. And in talking with him, I learned some information that made me nervous. In the handout or this PowerPoint that you put together, it showed that for the stolen vehicles, the Amber Alerts, the warrants, the terrorist hot list, and the other hot list managed by the state. But they had also informed me that if a task force or an investigator wished, they could put a license plate, a hit in that system themselves on their own. Now, if there's just for Isani County or Mille Lacs County or St. Louis County, if there's only one in that county, it doesn't do any tracking. But if a jurisdiction has multiple LPRs, just on a whim, an investigator could then track a person by having that particular vehicle in the system. Right now, it takes a search warrant to put a GPS tracker on a vehicle. By being able to download a license plate into that system right now without any paperwork, without any probable cause, just on suspicion, if a department has enough LPRs, they can now track that vehicle. And I was just wondering your opinion on that. If your policy is ever going to allow your investigators to do that, or if as a legislative body we need to take care of that issue before it's an issue. Because I do believe that this technology is good, it's going to help law enforcement. But we have what's called fruit of the poison tree in evidence gathering, and I would hate to see a good case go bad because something's used improperly.
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, that as you saw in the demonstration, the technology has a lot of capabilities, and creating databases is one of those capabilities. One of the slides that I spoke about a little bit was regarding the safeguards, and I think what's important for any agency that uses LPR is to have good written policies that prevent people who are on a whim just looking to track license plates. Our system, I think many of the systems require a case number, written notes as to why you're querying the database. And when you put in place those policies and you conduct regular audits, I think you'll catch people who are not using it appropriately and take appropriate action when that happens. Now, there's a lot of technology in law enforcement that have a lot of sophisticated capabilities, and I think policies and procedures, perhaps legislation, is the way we're going to, you know, safeguard ourselves from misuse. And what the future of this technology is, I guess I don't know. I'm sure it will get even more sophisticated. But written policies protect, I think, the agency, and when you have those audits, and if there's a desire to have someone else audit that use, an external agency such as the BCA or someone else, we're open to that. We want appropriate checks and balances so that there is there is no misuse, and B, there's a perception from you all in our communities that there's not misuse.
Mr. Neumeister.
If I may go back, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, go to page 31 and 30. You'll see this is the BCA by the Department of Public Safety. This is the hot list, or whatever you want to call that, most agencies refer to. Now, there's a split here. The state has their own little mini file, and then the feds put in. Now, the locals can do their own little two cents, too. And that's where some of the issues. The issue is also across the country, databases that are on a statewide basis, there have been issues of accuracy and incompleteness, of inaccuracy, and just like with NCIC or anything. And so what's starting to see in the literature, in news reports and all that, on LPRs, people are being stopped. And then for what reasons, and they find out later it's a false. So again, the more information there is, thing to do. On the second item that you talked about, the technology and the policies and all that, the issue is who the policies are in the eyes of. Again, long time interaction with law enforcement agencies over the long period of time. Many times the policies are in their eyes, not necessarily either in balanced eyes or towards the public. Because sometimes, as you know, law enforcement does have a lot of power. So I just want to share with you, Minneapolis, for example, has their own little list several years ago. And even when I discovered that Minneapolis was doing LPRs, they didn't really have a policy until 2013. And I just want to add at least one other thing about the aspect of it, is that when people are stopped using LPRs, the only agency where I could get, was it stopped because of an LPR hit, was only Bloomington to where I could get confirmation of that. If you ask any of the agencies that I talk to, can you tell me what happened to the hit? Did you arrest the person? Did you do that? Did you do that? The systems weren't talking. And only with the hard work that Chief Potts would have done, and his commander, Ryan, who I spoke with, would I've been able, but I didn't want to waste their time on that because I was seeing a pattern.
Chief Potts, I'm just curious. You mentioned that there are frequent audits done. Who currently audits your LPRs on the regular basis?
So in our policy, we recognize a system administrator be a person on the command staff that oversees our investigative division, which is where typically those queries are run. So we limit that to our system administrator currently.
Okay, so you said there were public audits done, but that sounds like an internal audit.
Correct. The internal audit can be made public. We're talking in this presentation about safeguards that can be put in place, the current legislation that's being proposed. There is no, obviously, as you know, there's no requirement on that, and so we're doing it internally at this point. If there's legislation that evolves from this, and you know, at the end of the session, these are some things that I think we're very welcome to in terms of that legislation. Restrictions on who can access it, audits, whether it's we conduct them ourselves or if there's another agency that would conduct that audit, and then the requirement of written policies and training regarding the access.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson, were you done with your questioning?
And just one follow-up.
Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Chief Potts, I think you may have missed what I was getting at. I'm talking about the local hit files where investigators, what was brought to me, like one of our task forces in our area could put a vehicle into the system because it's a known burglar so they can keep track of where he's going. That's a situation that I'm concerned about doing without some type of court paperwork allowing that to go into that system.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. Chief Potts. You mentioned on page 2 that the LPRs are not capturing every Minnesota's plates. So does the police officer selectively turn on the device depending on the day or the situation they're involved in?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, what I meant by that is those mobile units currently are only capturing the plates of the vehicles that they encounter during the course of a shift. It's typically turned on when they begin the shift or when the vehicle is running, and they capture only those. And with only 17%, they're certainly not seeing every car in the state. They're just seeing those cars in which they come across during the course of that shift.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you, Chief Potts. So every vehicle the officer encounters throughout their shift is recorded.
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is. I don't think technically possible, but based on the angle, the way the cameras are angled, they get
most cars that are coming directly at them or directly away from them. That wouldn't be every car. There's certainly cars at 90-degree angles. Technologically, the system doesn't have the capability of catching those, but certainly those that are coming directly at them or in their rear going the opposite direction.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Potts, in your information, you provided that there are a significant number of incidents that are reported after 90 days in your city of Bloomington. I believe the number was 212. Yes, 212 incidents that are reported after 91 days. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, in our 2014, that is the number when we researched for this that we came up with. Part one crimes only, which includes homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, arson, theft, burglary. Those part one crimes, 212 reports that we took had an occurrence more than 91 days prior to the report of the crime.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Potts. So then could an argument be made that the data should be stored for longer than 90 days, perhaps 180 or 360?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative. It certainly could. I think what is important here is one of the things I mentioned. We're trying to strike balance here. And what is that balance? I think, you know, from certainly there would be cases where 180 days would be helpful. But I think in our current climate, I'm not sure that, you know, 180 days is something that a lot of other folks think is reasonable. And so we're trying to strike what we think is a healthy balance there that continues to allow us to use this technology to solve some of these cases, and perhaps not all of them, but try and find that balance that everybody would be okay with.
Mr. Neumeister.
If I just may, at least with the technology, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the technology is changing. If you take a look at my color packet of photos, you'll see on the last page, that was a 3M one just a few years ago. So you'll see that's the pictures. But what's happening now, they're becoming flat, and they're on a car, and their view is wider and more sophisticated. And this is where the new technology is online. So it captures more and it captures faster. So I'm just sharing with you that things are changing. So a picture you may have had 4 or 5 years ago that takes some things, now it may take a little bit more wider. Again, the vendors are moving with their technology.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Potts, you mentioned on page 7 that retention rates, there's the policy in Minnesota currently, and I certainly understand you're not responsible for the entire state, but policy rates, retention rates rather, are between 48 hours and 90 days. But is this simply a policy where an agency could be holding the data for significantly longer than that and no one would know?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is the case. The policies are all public, though, and I think anybody who's using LPR is creating a policy. I'm not sure about the agency that was spoke about earlier here, but usually what happens is when the technology is put in place, that a written policy goes with it, and data retention is certainly covered in these written policies from the agencies that I'm aware of. In Minnesota, a couple years ago, there was a lot of research, and there were agencies who did have it longer than the 90 days, but have, because of some of these discussions, have dialed it back to 90 days. I will point out that there are a lot of states where there is legislation on data retention that is significantly longer than 90 days, such as Washington, D.C. at 3 years, New Jersey's at 5 years, in New York City, I think, as well, or New York is also in the 3 to 5 year range. And here in Minnesota, though, I think we've found ourselves kind of dialed back to most cases somewhere around on the top end 90 days.
Mr. Neumeister, you had a comment on that?
Yeah, Chair Scott, Representative Smith, there is no state law or statewide policy that dictates it has to be 90 days. It varies, and it can vary. And what has happened because of the public discussion, some agencies have voluntarily maybe gone back to 90 days. But there is no rule that says it has to be. Some people got confused when the temporary classification went in a couple of years ago that makes certain data private, that the Department of Administration said it was 90 days. Now, on the other hand, on the longer lengths, what's happening now, if you take a look at the literature, particularly with the things in the Wall Street Journal and other things that have been happening, people are starting to know information is being shared a lot. It's starting to be used on monitoring First Amendment activities, using sophisticated integration of the data. So you're seeing a rollback across the country, 7 days, outlawing them, whatever. I mean, Virginia Senate just recently passed 7 days. So the technology came out, boom, a lot of reaction from the public, and now you're starting to see either 0, 7 days, could be 2 weeks, who knows. So it is a debate happening across the country, and we're just also part of that.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. Chief Potts, recently I spoke with my Sheriff Stanek of Hennepin County, and he told me his agency is using this data and storing it for 30 days. So as the public policy group, how do we differentiate the differences of opinions that the different agencies store this data and their use? How do we come up with the appropriate number, regardless of what that number is?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's a good question. You know, in the city of Bloomington, where I work, in the community that I serve, our city council had a debate over this issue and had much discussion. We shared examples in our case of data that was 64 days old, and they all knew of the case that I just described to you. They lived it for the 60-some days while somebody was throwing things out their car and hitting, you know, and there was certainly potential for much more significant injuries. And so in telling that of that real-life example, that our council was comfortable with 90 days. I think it is a challenge to come up with a number that everybody is going to say we all agree that that's the right number. You know, one thing we haven't talked about a lot in these hearings and in other meetings is the use of this technology in our efforts in counterterrorism. And I think one of the issues out on the, as we go about 1,500 miles to the east, where they have had real examples of terrorism, Boston, for example, in the Boston Marathon bombings, LPR data was used to successfully find and prosecute so far on that case. Not just hit data, the data was very instrumental. And there are locally counterterrorism cases, particularly at the Minneapolis International Airport, where LPR data has been useful in those investigations. It doesn't get talked about publicly a lot, but I will tell you that I have spoken to the people who have used it. I've gotten their permission to express this to you today, that LPR is used in counterterrorism, both in a prevention and an investigation, in the investigation of those cases. And you can't go a day without reading about ISIS or al-Shabaab or al-Nusra and their threats against the West. And this technology is it's become very important in those investigations.
But
so to come on a day or to try and agree on a number of days, I think is very challenging until you have a discussion including all the uses of it and its potential.
I think it's important to state here, though, that if we put a camera on every corner in the city, we would probably cut down on a lot of crime and a lot of terror. We'd probably catch a lot of terrorists, but we live in a free society. And so that's the balance that we have to strike here, folks, is what price are we willing to pay in a free society to have that kind of security, so-called security. Representative Smith, were you finished with your line of questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can direct this to Mr. Neumeister or anybody in the room that can do this for me. But can you, on your page 21, can you show me or trace Mr. Rybeck's daily route? Can you show me on December 20th, 2011, where he went that entire day?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen.
No, they didn't.
Before what happened, what the Star Tribune reporter did, he went and asked Minneapolis, and he says, hey, I would like to, wherever, you know, the cameras, where it captures that. So what you're able to do with this kind of information, and I illustrate that in the color photograph of where it collects of where you go, you would be able to get the longitude, latitude, at what time, probably get a picture, as demonstrated in the Pioneer, in the second article I showed you. So you would probably be able to get an idea, approximate kinds of things, and this is what law enforcement does in certain areas. If they're just doing a pattern recognition, that's one of the things they do. They'll put on somebody and where the person goes, and then they'll come up with assumptions about that person. So this was from their website. They didn't share all the information, but at that time, that information was public. So you would be able to detail if, Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, if you put a person's name in, Rich Neumeister, and if he drove a car, and you collected and where how many cameras in a city or whatever is have, or cross-jurisdiction. On the cross-jurisdiction, just as a courtesy to let you know, there's been discussion with St. Paul on to have an East Metro kind of jurisdiction with Maplewood, Woodbury, and St. Paul, so there would be cross-sharing. You would probably be able to get some things, depending where the car is parked. Very similar to what the pictures I showed you at the beginning. They were at parked locations, and it would have that information. And so you develop a pattern.
Madam Chair. And you also offered a statement that said that you know of people that were stopped for false reasons. And found out it was through the license plate reader. What were those reasons?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, I've said that there are articles that are starting to appear across the country, not here in Minnesota, that people are being stopped based on the hits. And it could be for stolen car, whatever the particular is in that item. But the point is that some of those things are based on false information or inaccurate information, just like there's been a history of NCIC, BCA data, whatever database, there's a certain percentage that are always, that's inaccurate or not complete. So I'm just saying that's a trend. I don't know if that's happened here because, Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, it's very hard to get information from police agencies. Some I get, some I don't, some I don't want to waste the time because I've asked those kinds of questions and I, you know, you can only do so much. That may have happened because I wanted to drill down to see how people, what was hit. And if I can't get that information, I can't verify. There was a good faith effort on my part over the last half decade to try and see how, what was happening to the information, what was happening to the people who were being hit. Was it based on false information? Or was it not? Because under the Data Practices Act, once a hit happens, it all becomes public. It's just like a call for service, a call for, so we the public can see how this technology is being used. And so all I'm saying is I'm seeing trends, and I can give you a couple of the articles that I have seen.
I might add here, I've talked to an officer that I know, and this person told me that a lot of times, and this may be just maybe their reader is an older model or something, but this person told me that the data was incorrect, that they would it would show a hit, and then they would go ahead and look it up themselves and find out that there wasn't a warrant or that wasn't a stolen car. So I do think that that does happen. But go ahead, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to your point, it just shows how professional law enforcement is in Minnesota. I think we have some of the best trained in the country, and we've proven that time and time again. But clearly, your statement happens is when I'm driving around in my squad car, Mr. Neumeister, I can run a plate just like Chair Scott just pointed out because the due diligence is to confirm those things and to make sure it's the right person or right thing before you stop it. But I also can't prevent say Minneapolis impound lot from forgetting to take a car out of the NCIC hit as a stolen car, or plates that are revoked if DVS is slow to change the fact that somebody is revoked. When I walk up to the car and I stop somebody for driving after revocation, they present me the paperwork and they go about their day. That is going to happen. That's not that whether we have license plate readers or not. Those things are still going to happen. Now, my question is, simple yes or no, is would you just prefer we just stopping cars? Because the human interaction here of entering the information is still going to be there, whether we have license plate readers or someone is putting it into NCIC. And I'm glad we're having this discussion because all these things are very important to all of us.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, for me, I'm trying to articulate for my own self what the question is. Are you basically?
Well, let me help one more second.
So,
my question and pseudo statement, because that's what we do here sometimes, is you know, really, Mr. Neumeister, what's your preference? Should we just stop doing traffic stops? Because I can promise you, until the end of time, as long as humans are involved, no matter what sector of the world it is, whether it's government, police, realty, bankers, doctors, there's going to be some error, a margin of error that's involved with the business that happens. And we try to limit it to our best. So is it your opinion, because of that error, we should just quit stopping cars even if they come up as stolen because it might be the wrong person or it might be inaccurate information?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, no. You know, I think I illustrated an overall broad informational purpose some of the issues. I'm not here to, you know, on that particular point, no. I believe it's important to stop people when something articulates that. I do believe that technology can be helpful in some of those things. My comments are just saying about the databases and the kinds of situations that are happening. And Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, you know, I'm not making a molehill or a mountain out of the comment. It seems like you're grabbing onto it and saying, oh, you don't want. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying what technology does. And the impact of technology, this is one of the things. It goes to a bunch of Supreme Court cases and all across the board. How an amalgamation of information in a centralized database, broadly shared, can have impact on people's lives. Detained. And Madam Chair, one other thing.
Yes.
I'm the last person left that was 20 years ago that was put on the CRIMNET board. I was put on there as a citizen with privacy background. This is where the whole integration of criminal justice information, of the Katie Porrick money and all that. So you have MRAP. So you have, you can find criminals at the right time, at the right place. And one of the things that we considered, that we did in our privacy impact statements, was on the error rate. So this is nothing new about talking about databases and error rates, because amalgamation of computerized data has impact on people's lives, particularly if it's false. So, to your long answer to your question, but I hope I've answered it to what you feel.
Well, Madam Chair, then maybe I misunderstood how you were saying what you said, because when you made a statement, when you said that reasons were false and didn't offer any information as to what those stops were, it kind of indicts my profession, because I think we're a professional group. And yes, the point being is it doesn't matter where that the reasoning comes from. There's human interaction, whether it's the license plate reader or any database, but don't make it sound like you're indicting the officers here. And that's what it sounded like to me, so I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Chair Scott.
Mr. Neumeister, did you want to respond to that?
No.
Okay. All right. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Chief Potts. Chief, how long have you been in law enforcement?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, just about 25 years.
Representative Zerwas.
So, Chief, you probably started. Did you start before there were computers in the squad? Not to date you.
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, yes, the first squad car I drove did not have a computer.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, when you first got computers, wasn't one of the first kind of fun or interesting or effective ways to utilize an MDT in a squad car as you drove around to enter in license plates and follow up on suspicious activity or vehicles or track down stolen vehicles?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. It's a very helpful tool.
And
Representative Zerwas.
Chief, when you were on the street and you were patrolling, before your shift, did you have a roll call or a muster where you were told what's going on, given a list of stolen vehicles or other suspect vehicle descriptions?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, every shift starts with that.
Representative Zerwas.
And when you were driving around and saw a vehicle that matched that description and matched that license plate, did you initiate a traffic stop?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas. Absolutely.
Representative Zerwas.
Other than seeing a lot more license plates a lot more effectively and stopping a lot more cars and catching a lot more bad guys, what's the difference between LPR and your eyeballs?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, when you put it that way, I guess not much.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, Mr. Neumeister, one of the things that we're dealing with here, and you bring up, is the data and the data sharing. And I've been sitting here thinking about it. I'm concerned about the data sharing everywhere with other agencies, but I also know without sharing data, a lot of crimes could not be solved. And one of the biggest issues that in my lifetime that we dealt with because of barriers and walls put in place to stop data sharing happened a number of years ago, where over 3,000 people were killed. Because of lack of data sharing, we had September 11th.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, to your last point, I think I may have looked at it that way initially, too. And then I read the decision and statement by the U.S. Supreme Court only a few years ago stating that while the subject matter of this has not come before the court specifically, if in fact government has the ability to track you everywhere you go on the map here, it may very well be unconstitutional. So while it may seem to the uninitiated that this is the same thing as just seeing a car, scribbling it down on your pad, trying to drive, keyed it into your computer, seeing it come back on Channel 5 or whatever, and then making the stop, the United States Supreme Court does see it as substantially different. I think that's one of the things we're dealing with here. And then to your point, Representative Schoen, I think there is a tendency to see this as an attack on law enforcement. But just as we in the legislature, where we're in the position to make decisions and powerful decisions, sometimes we feel under attack in our communities because we're making the decisions and we're in the position of power. And I don't think that Mr. Neumeister asking questions about the implementation of this technology should be seen as an attack on law enforcement. It's simply the fact that law enforcement is in the position of wielding the power here, and so we're asking the questions. It may get a little bit close to that line sometime, and so I would caution testifiers to be careful, choose their words carefully. However, in this case, law enforcement is wielding technology, and so I think the pointed questions are properly placed in most cases. To that point, Madam Chair, Chief Potts, the cases that you cited, especially the one where the guy was throwing stuff around on Normandale Boulevard, can you envision any case that you've cited wherein this technology has been useful in apprehending a bad guy, whereby if you couldn't access it, you would certainly be able to get a warrant for it? In other words, if this data had been held but was not readily and easily viewable by you, is there a judge in Hennepin County who would not have given you a warrant to see it in order to investigate this incident on Normandale Boulevard?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. So the question of whether or not we could, if there was a requirement, get a warrant, I think you probably could. In our case, you know, and in other cases where the technology was used, it's used fairly quickly in that process to query the process of getting a search warrant to query a database that you have at your agency takes time. Not to say that it can't be done or that a judge wouldn't issue that warrant, because I think you could probably create a process whereby that could happen. It just is not the practice for other databases, and instead putting in place some restrictions on what the requirements are to access it is what we've done. So I think the short answer to your question is absolutely, you probably could create a process where a judge would sign a search warrant, which is for probable cause. In this case,
you know, whether it's a legitimate law enforcement purpose or reasonable suspicion is the criteria for searching the database, we just don't have policies or procedures in place that require a search warrant to do that.
Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Chief Potts and members. I think that's one possible way out of this pickle. For me personally, I don't necessarily know if probable cause is the full standard by which we should expect is a threshold before you search this. But just as is the case when you're driving around, as Representative Zerwa cited, you can stop that vehicle if you have reasonable suspicion, not necessarily full-blown probable cause. To the extent that LPR gives us that opportunity, I think it should probably be within the same parameters. So that nothing more, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Blesch. I had a question for Chief Potts. Have you ever been approached by any other local, state, or national agency asking for access to any of the databases that you have as far as where the LPR information is kept?
Madam Chair, yes, our agency has gotten phone calls from other agencies that are investigating cases in their own jurisdictions and are ask if they, with their own reasons, would be able to have us search our database, and that has happened. But we've placed the same requirement on them, which is we want to know exactly what it is that they're investigating and for what reason they'd like us to query our database. And with that information, we do share in the interest of trying to help them solve their cases. But it's not idle curiosity. It's with good reason. It's, you know, at this point, we need a case number. We want to know what the investigation is, just like we would hold our own folks to that same standard.
Okay. And do you have any agreements with private entities for data sharing?
Madam Chair, no, we do not have any agreements with private organizations, nor do we share our data with private organizations.
Do private organizations share their data with you?
Madam Chair, no.
So the Mall of America doesn't share their data with you? That's purely private data?
Madam Chair, are you referring to license plate reader data?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
The Mall of America does not have access to any LPR data at this point in time, so there is no sharing with the Mall of America with regard to license plate reader data.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that in some states they put restrictions on the license plate reader data, and then like insurance companies have started doing their own. Are you aware of how much that's happening with private companies or private entities doing those license plate readers?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. I don't have specifics, but I do know that it's becoming more and more popular for private entities to use license plate readers, whether it's insurance companies with regard to repo companies, other locations such as casinos and things like that. There is far more private use of LPR systems than there is law enforcement use in this state. And those entities, I think, do have the ability, technically, certainly, but whether or not they are or not, have the capability of sharing information. We, however, are not sharing our information with them, nor are we, in Bloomington specifically, seeing the data that they collect either.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So based on Mr. Neumeister's slide here on page 27, we actually did an iPhone app search to see if there was public apps available to do a license plate reader search. And in fact, we found a number of states that have it, Texas, California, New York, already have those license plate reader apps available just on the iPhone that anybody can buy. Is all of the information that law enforcement gets from that first initial read, is that all public information? So if someone had an app here in Minnesota, would they be getting who owns the vehicle or who the is that all public information anyways, or is what you get on that initial read any private data?
Chief Potts.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the systems that we're using take a picture and mark it with a date and time and location. That's the data that's being stored. That, by temporary classification, is private as of the temporary classification. In the system that houses that,
there is no registered owner of the vehicle. The personal data that's associated with that license plate is not part of what we are storing. We're simply storing a picture. The system has the capability of converting that picture alphanumerically into letters and numbers, but the data that we're storing is that picture of that license plate as numbers and letters associated with it, but not personal data. So not only is it private, but we don't even store that information on the server.
Mr. Neumeister, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, on two things. One, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, about the private companies. From the packet that you described, that's Vigilant Solutions. Vigilant Solutions is one of the vendors. And as part of their agreements, depending on, and I had this example with Ramsey County, what they'll do is they'll say, okay, we're going to give you all this equipment, blah, 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 share the information with us, and then you get access to our database. It's one of the marketing things that's happening. The point is that when I saw the contract that Ramsey County had, I said there's some issues here. And they redid their contract to make sure that was very clear that the information that they get through their LPRs is not placed into the private company's LPRs. Vigilant Solutions is one of several companies, and they're going around the country, and now they're going to law enforcement and say, hey, would you like the amalgamation of private LPR scans? And then, you know, like a law enforcement agency would contract out to this company. So that is this happening. On the second point that was raised by Representative Hillstrom's question, Madam Chair, the information is you get all that information. You get the camera. You get people that are involved around the area. So it's more than just a plate, and as I described to you. But the connection where the name is with the database, you know, because you put in the license plate, you know, at the state, the local, or whatever, that's where the name attachment is. And how they do that in the system, I've not seen any data that I can look at that, those issues. But there is the link between the name and the location.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you actually get a hit or don't, and you have that license plate, photograph, date, and time, what steps then have to be taken to actually link the personal information with that? I mean, that's not done automatically. It's not done through the system. Does it take a law enforcement officer to actually open it up and search it? What's the process that those two pieces get linked together? Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. So, I'll talk through our example. We identified a suspect. So we had a name. And we then can find out the vehicles that that person is associated with, typically the ones that they own. And then you can then find the license plate number of that vehicle, and you take that license plate number and run it in the database. So is this example was brought up earlier about Mayor Rybeck's vehicle. Really what happened there was a license plate associated with Mr. Rybeck was run in the database. Mr. Rybeck's name is not in the database. It's all associated to a vehicle. And do we always know who's driving the vehicle? No, we don't. But we do know a license plate of a vehicle can be associated with a person, and it's that license plate, though, that we run against the database. There's always people associated with license plates. The system can tell you who the registered owner is, or an investigation may tell the detective who's typically driving it. It may not be the registered owner. It may be a suspect that doesn't own it, a relative or something. But we need to know the license plate number, and then we can run it against that database to see if it did encounter a squad car that has moving license plate reader technology, or in a few cases, it passes by a fixed location. But there's very few of those.
Members, we need to move on to body cams. Mr. Neumeister, one last remark.
Yeah, I thought there'd just be a couple of remarks the final. Mm-hmm. It was my purpose, Madam Chair, members of the committee, to provide a wide breadth of information on what's happening. Sometimes in discussion, we talk about policy, but the technology. So we tried, I think both Chief Potts and myself tried to provide that information. The issue about zero retention, 90 days, those are issues I did not intend to get into in terms of the policy, and that will probably be sometime in the future. But the bottom line is no ands, if, or buts about it. is that this is a conflict about privacy, liberty, and technology. Innocence, presumed, data, what? So it's a big chomp to talk about, and hopefully we'll see what happens as it progresses.
Right,
and thank you very much for the opportunity. This is I really appreciate all hundreds and hundreds of times I've appeared before a committee. I've not been formally invited except once or twice. And so I want to thank you very much.
Thus the suit. All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. And let's have our next testifiers up on the body cams. Members will operate this the same way we did with the previous testifiers. Each of the testifiers will be given about 8 minutes to give an opening statement, and then we can ask questions. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, and we'll go ahead with our law enforcement person first.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Eric Gieske, Burnsville's police chief. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to be here today to talk about body cameras. It's my understanding I was asked to come here today to kind of do a show and tell and explain where Burnsville Police Department's at with respect to body cameras. But before I do that, I'd like to say a couple of things. I'd like to recognize that each individual police agency has its own unique culture, so I'm going to talk today about what has worked well for Burnsville Police Department. I'd also like to point out we didn't start body cameras because we had a problem. I know some agencies are concerned about use of force issues. We did it, I think, to demonstrate the professional agency that we do have and to get out in front of it. We're, as I understand it, the first in the state to deploy these. We didn't do it because we wanted to be the first. We did it because we believe that it's a very good tool. It demonstrates accountability and transparency. With that said, I'll start back to when I started in Burnsville in 1989. As Representative Zerwas pointed out, we didn't have computers in the squads at that time. Probably the most sophisticated piece of equipment was a police radio followed by a pen and a 3M sticky paper. You had to write down an address if you were sent somewhere. So we've evolved quite a bit. Our first shot at cameras was in the early to mid-90s. We started with an in-squad camera, and I'd like to point out back then the cameras were really large, similar to what you'd see like a big VHS recorder. We had one in-squad camera at the time. It didn't last all that long. The biggest challenge with that at the time, it was so big, officers complained about driving. It wasn't safe, and also storing the actual VHS tapes were quite cumbersome. So that was our first effort at actually any type of in-squad camera or camera system at all. We quickly aborted that. It wasn't until 2007 when we actually started in-squad cameras a second time. We deployed about five of them. Again, a very valuable tool. It caught a lot of the enforcement action that the officers were taking. We did recognize, however, in-squad cameras were problematic, specifically for our agency, for a number of reasons. But one of the things that haunted the police administration at the time, and I was a captain at the time, was the fact that that same year, 2007-2008, we actually had a number of squad cars that were actually rear-ended while they were out on traffic stops. In my opinion, one of the challenges with in-squad cameras, you're asking the officer to get in front of that vehicle to do enforcement action. You're also asking a citizen to get in front of that vehicle so you can record and document the events as they are occurring. That's a dangerous place to be. I'd hate to see a citizen or an officer get hurt. So that played into our decision-making process moving forward and looking at different opportunities. Actually, our third version of any type of camera system was, again, about that same time. We had been using electronic control devices or tasers for several years, and we actually were made aware of a product that Taser provided. It was a camera at the end of a taser. So the theory behind that is if you're going to use force against somebody, you should record that contact. Unfortunately, with that, it usually captures just the end portion of the contact when someone's being tased. At the same time, we were made aware that Taser made a product called an officer camera or point of view camera, and I'll show you what one of those looks like. So while we still had the in-squad cameras, the first camera that we were made aware of and we tried to use, or we did use successfully, I believe, in the field, was this actual camera here. It's a Taser product. It's called the Axon. Its model is called the Pro. Now, we were not the first agency in the United States to use this. Actually, Aberdeen, South Dakota, was the first agency to actually test and deploy these. And we actually, myself included, went to Aberdeen to see how they used it in the field, looked at their policy, and learned a lot from them. So we were excited about it because it did a number of things. As you can see, the disadvantage, a lot of cables. There's a lot of cables connected to this. And what I'd like to show is this is actually the computer that was attached to the head cam. Now, when they talk about point of view camera, we're actually talking about this. This was the first model that we had in roughly 2010. Works well for me. We have a number of females on the agency, and it didn't work well for some of them. And it was difficult to wear. Actually, I spent a shift wearing this. But when you talk about point of view, that's exactly what it offers. It doesn't necessarily capture where I'm looking at, but it does do that. The problem is a 10-hour shift can become a little uncomfortable. But we tested this product. I thought we had good success with it. As you can see, the cables attached to this computer that we use. The advantage to this, of course, this system was, and I'll just pass this around if that's okay. What we liked about this system was it was also playback, so you could actually make a traffic stop or have a contact with an individual if there was a discrepancy, whether or not they had actually gone through a stop sign or what the violation was that we may have observed. We could actually play it back for them. The other advantage of this, we could actually tag the video or record the case file, so we had a way to track the information and the videos that we were recording. The other feature we liked about this, other than it's very cumbersome, difficult to wear, difficult to mount, was each of these units is plugged in after a shift. The information is uploaded. But in order to get these out, you actually have to do a log, and so we know which officers have which camera system or which computer. So that worked well for us. The problem is the camera started to malfunction, and eventually, because it was so cumbersome to wear, they stopped making that product. So then we went on to the second model or phase. And again, you can see the design, much smaller. It attaches to this unit right here. And again, we lost a lot because we couldn't necessarily tag the video like we could there. But again, you're seeing they're starting to downsize. Finally, we realized even that was troubling to manage the cables, so we went to the actual third phase. And this is what we have right now. The actual body camera attaches right to your chest. You have to manually activate it. The downside with this, of course, we didn't have a way to tag the video. We actually needed to supply our officers with phones so they could tag the video through an app that was available to us. So I'll also pass this around.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the one that's wireless, do you ever have a connection issue so it's so you think it's recording and ultimately it isn't recording?
Nope. There's nothing connected to it. Everything's compact in here. I'll pass it around so you can see the actual cameras right in here. It just mounts to your chest.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it storing then in that actual camera, so the storage piece is right inside here? It's not sending it to store it somewhere else?
Correct. And it's stored on there to the end of the shift, and once you put it into like a mounting or bracket system, it actually uploads, and each officer with this model, they're assigned their individual unit, so we know which camera belongs to which officer, if that makes sense.
Representative Leshen, I would like to let him finish his testimony eventually. Go ahead.
And I'll just pass this model around.
Go ahead.
So I can't ask a question. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll move. Chief Gieske, I have to ask this question on behalf of the prosecutors out there. Now, I've been tasked with doing 10-to-demand trials back at my other job, which means that not only now, before within a week essentially that I got to go to trial, do I have to have an in-car camera, a dash cam, now a body cam, some other kind of recording, five or six other recordings. Are you poised in your position to get your prosecutors all these new different kinds of evidence now that they need in order to be prepared to go to trial?
That's a good question. One of the things, my apologies, Madam Chair. That's a good question. We have, the way we use it for Burnsville, our video stored in web-based storage, evidence.com, so we can give administrative rights to the city and county attorneys so they can access the video and they have what they need.
Okay, that'd be great. And Madam Chair,
Representative
and if you can, my boss, Jessica McConaughey, is sitting right up there. If you could go tell her how to have St. Paul cops do that too, that would be awesome. This would be much quickly. And I just have one other question, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Chief Geske, did you have a policy in place for your officers before you implemented this? And I mean a policy, not an SOP.
Yeah, we had my apologies, Madam Chair. We had in-squad camera policy. We also had a model policy from Taser and also from Aberdeen, South Dakota that we used when we deployed them.
Okay, but Madam Chair, was this a policy that was actually passed by policymakers like your city council or something?
Mr. Geske, or Chief Geske.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, we don't put our policy in front of the city council, so it was an internal policy that was reviewed and distributed to the officers.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Chief Geske, go ahead with your testimony, and we'll extend you two more minutes.
Okay, my apologies.
The question.
A lot to cover here. So with that said, the other piece of this that we found success in initially was some of the evidence that we were gathering or capturing was, quite frankly, amazing. Fortunately, we don't have that many homicides in Burnsville, but we deployed these in July of 2010. A few months, actually January of 2011 was the first time we responded to a shooting, and the officers arrived and discovered it was an actual homicide. And they got the suspect coming out of the house. He made an admission that he actually shot somebody. The officers went into the house. They could see that the victim was there. They could see where the rifle was or the shotgun that was used. So for us, after that, we were believers. We could see that it preserved evidence in such a way that helped us build that case. And I know the county attorney at the time was also very grateful to have that kind of evidence. So we have a lot of examples and experiences that I could talk about. But that's the one that really comes to mind the most. So with that, I'll open it up if there's questions. That's kind of a quick snapshot of a lot of information.
All right. We're going to go ahead and hear from Mr. Gimberling, and then we'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Don Gimberling. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. If you'll indulge me, I sat back there and heard some questions in the previous testimony that maybe I can answer. Okay,
quickly.
Representative Smith asked about retention. We actually have a state law on retention of government information. Okay, it's Minnesota Statutes 138.17. And essentially it requires that for records that are official records, a government agency has to prepare a retention schedule, which has to be approved by a state-level panel. And once approved, then the government entity can follow that schedule. Okay. Now, schedules can vary. If one city wants a shorter retention period and the panel approves it, then it can use a shorter retention period. It can also use a longer retention period. So, squad car computers. My career in state government started in 1968. I spent 5 years working on criminal justice information systems. I was part of the original team that built the first statewide criminal justice information system. The first in-squad computers were actually implemented, I believe, in 1972, okay, in the city of Minneapolis. How do I know that? Because I worked on the project. Okay. And I got a kick out of Chief Geiske's comments. The complaint then was, I mean, these things were huge. Okay, I think part of the problem in Minneapolis was you couldn't have a partner because the computer took up the seat next to you. So just a couple of things that came up I thought I might be able to help you with. My colleague Matt Ealing from Minkoji, and for those of you who don't know about Minkoji, we're basically an all-volunteer organization. We're a 501c3. And we educate the public on issues of government transparency and accountability. And for the last few years, we've been coming up here to work on those issues. So Matt has prepared a handout, which I think everybody has. Actually, we did two handouts. We did one on LPRs. We did also one on body cameras. I'll just quickly review the contents of the handout on body cameras. First of all, it describes how we see body camera data as fitting into the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. Okay? And the basic conclusion is that the comprehensive law enforcement section of the Act, which is Minnesota Statute Section 1382, covers body cam data. That's a function of how data is defined in the Data Practices Act, or for purists, how data are defined in the Data Practices Act, and how that section would handle body cam data. So, obviously, with all government data, there's a presumption that the data are public, and then the legislature has spent years spelling out exceptions to the public presumption. So, the narrative goes on to talk about, describe the storage and retention of body cam data, and essentially, as Chief Geiske has told you, the stuff can be stored either with the vendor, uploaded from the cameras, or it can actually be stored locally, and that's an option that each department has in terms of deciding where to store it. The issues that we see with storing it with the vendor are very complicated, very complex, and I think something for you all to think about, because I think you're going to see more of this kind of product offering. For those of you who saw the AP story over the weekend and some of the reactions to it, if I were a vendor of these things, I'd be handing out free cameras, because once you have the storage contract signed, and Chief Geiske in a better position than I am to talk about the costs, then you're going to have an ongoing source of revenue beyond what selling the cameras one time does. However, from the standpoint of policymakers, you now have data sitting in the computers of a vendor who probably is not even located inside the borders of Minnesota. Okay? Years ago, some of us started realizing that with the internet, you could store data any place in the world. Okay? Now, you can also hack data from any place in the world, but that's a separate issue. So that's something to think about as you go on to consideration of how you're going to handle the data issues associated with body cameras. I think the last thing in the handout materials are sales materials from Taser Incorporated that describe a variety of products. They don't go into a lot of detail on the storage issues, but they certainly do offer that as a product. At the moment, the various issues presented by body cameras, I was quite interested in Chief Geiske's comment that the reason to do this is for the transparency and accountability. And I think that's the real base of what police management and local public officials are trying to accomplish with the implementation of the body cam technology. However, you then get into a whole series of issues associated with the implementation of that technology, and you've heard some of those issues, okay? And you're going to hear a lot more as the bills dealing with body cam data are considered by the legislature. So things that come to my mind, because I've been doing this so long, are thanks. One of the real difficult issues in the Data Practices Act implementation and regulation is the issue associated with multiple data subjects. Okay? It's real easy to deal with data if you've only got a picture of one person, because then you can figure out what their rights are and how the data are classified and all that sort of thing. However, when you have multiple data subjects, and particularly when you have those captured in images, then you've got an entirely different issue. I first encountered this issue when I was still working with the state, when somebody decided that the way to control the unruly behavior of children on buses was to put cameras on all the school buses. Okay? And not surprisingly, the first time our hypothetical Johnny was suspended from school for something he'd done on a school bus, mom and dad came in and said, I want to see what you made this decision based on. And the response often from schools was, well, wait a minute, all of the data on those cameras are private data, and we have several children who show up in the video. And we can't give you the video about Johnny because it has data about Susie and Ralph, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Those are the kind of issues you get into with images and that in multiple data subjects. In closing, and some of you, frankly, I think have heard this before, part of the perspective we try and bring to this discussion is for you to step back and think about what technology is doing to us as a society. Where do we want to be? I've said this before, and it's not based on my personal opinion. It's based on what I read. We do live in a surveillance society, okay? We just do. And I think part of your task is to decide what kind of surveillance society you want to live in. How far should we go? As Representative Scott pointed out, we can put cameras on every corner, and we could do away with a lot of crime doing that. But I'm not quite sure that that's the kind of society we want to live in. But maybe it is. I'm not a policymaker. I just have input into the process, thankfully. You are those makers. But I really encourage you to try not to get too focused on a specific technology, be it license plate readers or body cameras, but to think about the larger issue of what kind of society we want to live in. And frankly, in my case, what kind of society I want my grandchildren to live in. Thank you. If you have any questions.
Chief Geiske, you have a question. Prior to the temporary classification of this data, how did your department classify the data?
Madam Chair, it's a good question, and I think what we did is we mirrored what the state's guideline was as far as retention of it. Case files, for example, would be 7 years. A citation would be 3 years. And then we have what's called a 90-day retention for miscellaneous category. And the reason for that is, as Representative Schoen pointed out, there's a margin of error when you have to actually enter the case file. We want to make sure that we don't inadvertently mark something incorrectly that we would need. It also provides people an opportunity if they want to come in or have a question about a call that doesn't fall under a case file or citation, they would have access to look at that.
And did you ever have people off the street come in and ask for access to that data?
We do have requests for information, yes.
Okay, and how do you handle those?
Again, case by case. If we're required by law to release it or show it to them, we certainly do that, accommodate them.
Okay. One statement before we open it up for questions here, folks. Mr. Kimberlin, you alluded to this, and you know we have all these pictures. We saw all the various versions of these cameras that have evolved, as you put it. And I think there is, just as we always hear about the military-industrial complex, I think we're hearing more and more about this in this law enforcement-industrial complex, and where these vendors, because the technology is available, they're pushing it on, and they're showing law enforcement, gee, look what we can do with this information or with this technology. And it just keeps upping the ante. And as the ante is upped, I feel like our privacy and our personal space around us is shrinking. And all the while, these vendors are getting very, very wealthy, which, you know, I understand. I'm a free market person. So I'm kind of having an inner conflict about that whole thing. Can you address with me how much your department pays annually for storage of the data?
Sure. And to speak to your point, too, about the vendors, when we were making decisions if we should get a local server or use a web-based or a vendor, it wasn't something the PD did just by ourselves. We involve our IT folks that know much more about it than we do, so we do rely on other people. Currently, right now, we have 56 units that are out in the field, and the average cost is about $56 per month for storage. So we spend over $3,000 a month for storage of the video. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can the testifiers talk about the challenges of separating out non-public data and images in what's captured versus public? I know under current law, identity of child abuse victims, there's a whole list of things in the memo that Mr. Gemberling provided. And I'll admit that's something that I'm struggling with, is no matter where we draw the line, is if some portion of the data is public and some is non-public, the financial, logistical, kind of how departments can sort that out.
Chief Geiske.
Madam Chair, I can give you a good example. We do case by case, you have to review the video. It can be time consuming. You have to make sure you're not going to release video that you shouldn't. So we do have staff that'll have to review the video, each video. It's different than a police report where you could just simply read it and black out portions that aren't appropriate to release. So with that, we have staff that'll review it to make sure what we release is appropriate. And then we also, in one case, or cases that come in, we redact the footage that we're not allowed by law to release. So it can be can be time-consuming. One example, we had a 13-minute video where there were a number of people in the video. It took one of our staff members approximately 2 days of staff time to redact that. But we did it, and we were able to release that video. Does that answer the question?
Representative Pinto.
I guess so. I'm just trying to think about, I mean, so if it's 13 minutes and it took 2 days, I'm just trying to think about how often, I mean, is that, you know, is that a reasonable proportion we should be assuming? And then how does that work, again, no matter where we end up drawing the line in the end? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I know that that's a great question. I know there's discussion. They're actually trying to research ways to improve the redacting process for different software. Again, I don't have the IT background, but I know that's being looked at. So I'm optimistic moving forward it'll be an easier process. As it is today, it can be cumbersome and rather difficult, but it's manageable, at least for our department today.
Mr. Neumeister, did you have a comment on that? Or?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gamberling.
In the handout, there's some discussion of the methodology. Matt Ealing, my colleague, actually is in the video business. That's what he does for a living. And I think as Chief Geiske has indicated, because this stuff is digital, at some point, it's easier to deal with than like tape, okay, a VCR tape. But where the technology is on that, I frankly don't know. So,
Mr. Neumeister,
Madam Chair, I was one of the first people to ask for the body camera videos from City of Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and what they through Taser and Evidence Inc. They are. Have one person, and it basically comes to the point you ask for it and eventually you'll get it, which is with the accountability and transparency, and as described, they're working along the way with that. So I've seen a number of views, and things are blotted out, things are cut, and you get it in email, and it's pretty proficient.
Okay, and so thank you. And so Chief Geiske, then once you blur out someone's face, can you unblur it if you find later that could be exculpatory evidence of some sort?
Yes, you can.
You can, and so it would take an equal amount of time to unredact it or unblur it, or?
Madam Chair, no, not necessarily. You can take a look at the video, redact the copy that you're going to give to somebody, but you can also keep the other original in its original form.
Okay. Yeah, is that what you're going to say, Mr. Rivera?
Madam Chair, basically you make a copy and then you work with it.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Pinto, did you have further questions?
Good enough for now, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a kind of a line of questioning. So, do your officers have the ability to decide when to turn on and off the camera? Do you have a policy about that, or are they just on all the time?
Chief Geiske. Yeah.
Yes, we do have a policy. They have some discretion. They don't automatically turn on or turn off. Quite frankly, they couldn't last a 10-hour shift, so you have to factor in what the battery life is. So, yeah, we have policy that gives them guidance when it should be turned on and when it should not be turned on.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do all departments have that policy, or do many just leave it to the discretion of the officer of when to turn them on or when to turn them off?
Chief Geiske.
My understanding, most agencies that use them do have some policy in place. I can't speak to individual agencies or what their policy is, but I know for us we have one, and other agencies have talked to us, and we've shared our policy with other agencies.
So, Chief Geiske, if you go into someone's home, what's the policy on that?
It depends on the nature of the call. Typically, if you're taking enforcement action, you're involved in an arrest situation, you would activate it. Going to someone's home, it depends if you're invited. If you have a legal reason to be there and there's a good articulable reason to record what you're doing, we'd encourage the officers to record that interaction.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm concerned about children who are present that are not protected under data practices. So I've noticed that if they're the victim, protected private information. If they're a witness to an incident, they're protected if the release of their information then would put them in harm's way. If children are just simply present, for example, at a domestic assault, and they are not going to be harmed if their faces are disclosed, I believe current law does not protect their faces, and under current law, that video would have to be disclosed without blurring out their faces. Is that accurate?
How you see it?
Again, I'm not a legal expert on it. We case by case, and because there's so many variables in a particular call, I can tell you that we would have it reviewed if we're required by law to release it. We haven't had that experience of releasing video that sensitive with juveniles like that, and I'm not sure if we would release it. I would, again, consult with our city attorney or county attorney to get legal guidance. But that is a good question.
Mr. Gimberly.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as the handout we provided tells you, in some cases things are very clear as to whether or not data can be withheld because it's not public. The witness thing is problematic in one sense in that the policy you made a few years ago was to say that in making the decision as to whether or not there's potential harm to a witness or to their property, law enforcement agencies have to have in place a policy and procedure to make that determination. Okay? And frankly, that was a legislative compromise that was reached when that issue came up. Okay? Whether or not they're doing that, I think, is another question. I know I've had experience in dealing with cases where when you went to ask, does an agency have that policy in effect, the answer was they didn't. And you might want to hear from the continuum of law enforcement as to whether or not they're doing that. Because if they don't have it in place, then I don't know how they do what you ask them to do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also concerned about capturing people at different levels of clothing, being clothed. So, for example, you may go out to an incident and the person who's captured in the video who has maybe little or no clothing on may not be the victim in the case. Or you go out thinking that you're investigating something and it ends up not being a crime, and then upon the close of a case, a criminal investigation, that information becomes public. What happens with folks who maybe have, maybe they're naked, maybe they're in the bathtub, maybe, what happens with that video?
Chief Geiske.
Madam Chair, and to speak to that, our policy does cover that. We give officers guidance. It wouldn't be appropriate in most cases to even videotape them if that was the case. But again, given the totality of the circumstances, if the officer believed at the time it was appropriate, then they could explain why. That's a different situation. However, and maybe Mr. Gimberlin has a different opinion, I would think that would be offensive to the common sensibilities. I don't think that's the kind of information we want out there. And as a chief, I would have our city attorney weigh in, and I would try to prevent that video from being released. That's the concern that we all have. We don't want information being misused or placed on YouTube, those types of things. So we share the same concerns that I believe you do as well. We don't want information that could be damaging to individuals to be released. And so we're very careful with each case. And it does get complicated because there's several layers of information within each individual call.
Mr. Kimberly?
Just to clarify something, I've mentioned a couple of times that at some point the legislature imposed a compromise to resolve the issue of law enforcement data. I have the dubious distinction of being the person who drafted that compromise at the direction of the legislature. So, and I knew I had it right the day I walked into the Capitol after it was public, and I got yelled at by both law enforcement and the media. So the magic words, offensive to common sensibility, came from this sometimes fertile brain. Okay, I was just out of law school. What I was thinking about in part was some of the photos that law enforcement had shared with us with bodies in very bad condition, shall we say. But I frankly also thought about things like naked people. Okay. Now, as someone has pointed out, you know, offensive to common sensibilities may have changed since 1981. I don't do YouTube, but I see a lot of stuff on TV that's like my mother would have said, does that woman have a mother? But, you know, the judgment as to what is offensive to common sensibilities is rests with the law enforcement people like Chief Geiske. And based on what he just said, I think, you know, Burnsville's pretty much in conformance with what you were trying to accomplish.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is really my last question for today. I know there's going to be legislation about this, and we'll have a lot more debate about it. But you testified that 13 minutes of data resulted in 2 days of editing it and viewing it to make certain that no private information was disclosed. I saw in the media that in another state, a website made a ongoing request, data practices request, for all body camera video, and they plan to stream that on the website nonstop. So in the event, under Minnesota law, someone made an ongoing media request for all body camera data, under current law, would that one have to be provided? And two, do you have the capability to actually every day view every minute of body camera video that's taken to release to the press or to a website should they make that request?
That would be very difficult to accommodate that. If a massive data request was made, I'm not sure how our agency would handle that. We would make every best effort to do it. But again, because we have to be careful about what we're releasing, it would be labor intensive. It would take a tremendous amount of staff time, but we would certainly make every effort to do it. Fortunately, to this point, we haven't had those type of requests. So that is a concern, and other agencies are very aware of that as well.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Gimberling, do you believe if they didn't disclose it every day that then they would be complying with Chapter 13?
Mr. Gimberling.
Two or three issues. Whether or not a private party can make an ongoing request for data is a subject of dispute. Okay. So is there anything in the Data Practices Act that specifically deals with it? The answer is no. Okay. Some people honor ongoing requests, others do not. The Data Practices Act does say that an agency can, in the course of providing copies, including copies of images, recover its costs of searching out and retrieving the data. Okay? So that's kind of over here. Over here is policy that says an agency cannot charge for separating public from not public data. Okay? And, you know, we're talking about decisions that were made many years ago.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Mr. Gimberling just touched on one of the concerns that I've heard over and over. There's been some law enforcement agencies where individuals have come in, made broad requests. I want every recorded bit of video from officer so-and-so. I don't want the copy myself. We'll do what the data practices law allows us to do and come into your agency and view it and then only pay for the information which we want copied. And so that would require the agency to do all of that editing and separating and labor intensive for hours and hours and hours of video, when we heard from the chief that it's almost equating to a 1 minute, 1 hour ratio for a 13 minute video that took nearly 2 days. So now if we have this broad request under a data practice request to come in and view video, that could be extremely costly for an agency and extremely encumbersome. So I think that's something the committee should consider as we look forward. And then I think the other thing is, I think we have the phrasing from 1981 about the common sensibilities. Members, I would take that just a little bit further, in that in many agencies, first responders to a medical scene, into your home for a domestic or any type of thing, where maybe all of it would be under the current law of public data. And as a member that, you know, hey, I've been on the floor unable to move, suffering from a stroke, and my family called 911. I don't think that video serves a public need and serves a public good. I look terrible, and it's embarrassing. And I don't think that is what we should be going for. A lot of times folks individually interacting with law enforcement can be scary and traumatic enough. And I think if every Minnesotan has it in the back of their head, that's going to be on WCCO, what their living room looked like, what they looked like, what their neighbor is going to see. I think that is not what we should be looking at as far as policymakers to try to encourage positive interaction with law enforcement.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to touch on a couple things. The common sensibilities thing, and Mr. Gammerling, your co-board member, James Schiffer, wrote kind of on the lines of what you said, common sensibilities have changed big time. And, you know, he's advocating, well, we can all stomach this stuff now, so it should be released, is the way I'm reading his article. So just open it up and let people have it. So I do worry about that as far as when we're making policy here. We have a group that says what I'm hearing, but no one's saying directly, don't have body cameras at all. So there's some folks that are saying that. We have some folks that want to record the shift, the entire shift, so when I go to the bathroom, I'm being recorded. And, I mean, that's the reality of it, and so that is disturbing as well, too. So what is that fine line? What is the retention? What is the area? You said yourself these rules or the laws were written many, many years ago. And we didn't, I would think 40 years ago, that we didn't know that there would be a day that officers could walk into your home with a body-mounted camera. And even though you will say that, you know, we wrote it, it was a compromise, it was 40 years ago. I don't know but two people in the legislature that were here 40 years ago.
Representative
Maybe three. So yeah. my question is, what do you want us to do?
Representative Schoen, I would say one of the things that was stated earlier here today is that we don't want to come up with just a policy for body cams. We need to come up with an overall policy because the technology is going to continue to evolve. And so we need to come up, that's the challenge of the people around this table and in the legislature, is to come up with something that's going to, you know, do a broad sweep and will be a way for us to follow into the future of how to treat this data. But I'll let the testifiers go ahead and answer your question as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, actually some of us 40 years ago saw these kinds of possibilities. Because there are people who think about the implications of technology. Okay? One of them was an English guy named George Orwell. Okay? And, you know, I have a thing hanging in my house that says 1984 was not intended to be an instruction manual. Okay? And frankly, you know, if you try and it's not easy to do, try and stay on the cutting edge and think about where technology is going. And then, frankly, for me, I come here and try and help you understand where it's going so you can make good policy. And, frankly, that's what I've been doing for 40 years, okay? You know, I read an article yesterday that talks about a computer program that's being developed that reads your facial expressions, okay? And not only reads your facial expressions, but extrapolates from that what emotions you're feeling behind your face, okay? And where I go with that is, oh, we're going to hook that up to facial recognition technology, and then the rest is history, okay? I will concede to you that stuff was done 40 years ago, but, you know, you have to decide, based on what Chief Geiske mentioned, what's the reason for these things to be implemented, okay? And the reason for it is transparency and accountability. It's essentially to say that when an officer encounters somebody on the street, and there's some kind of interaction which has a negative implication. The officer gets hurt, the person gets hurt, you have a record of what happened. Now, do I think, given the state of technology, from a societal standpoint, that's probably a good idea? Yeah. Do I think videotaping people in their homes when they're nude is a good idea? Yeah, probably not, okay? But you make these decisions. But if your objective is transparency and accountability, you can't get there and have all of this stuff not public. It just doesn't get you there.
Madam Chair, I mean, I'm sorry. I think that, well, then that's what we're here to do, is to figure out how to find that fine line.
Right.
And I think we can. And so, but the problem we have, again, is we have polar opposites. Either don't do it at all, or record 24 hours a day and let everybody see everything. And so I think we need to figure out how to find that fine line. The chief doesn't get to go buy his body cameras without the approval of the council in Burnsville or any city council, because that's a capital expenditure that's going to need the approval. So it's not that when you call it the law enforcement industrial complex, you know, I mean, That he doesn't get to make that choice on his own, or nor does his administration. They get to make a recommendation just like they do to us on these policies. But again, we're talking about the data, and I don't want, I'm a cop. I don't want cops coming into my house and recording what's going on in the house and let everybody in the world see it, because one individual likes to go around and just ask, make data requests. And then it can be put on the web or YouTube. I mean, that's what our potential is. And I don't want my kids, as we pointed out, it's not clear. So we need to work on clarifying that. I don't want that out there because it's not clear. So I hope we can work on this, but we really have to be careful of what our language is, what we're using here today, too, is because the cops are only trying to do what city councils, the state legislature, because remember, when the cops are out on the street, it's what they're enforcing, what is brought into law here. Not what they're just making up. It doesn't work that way. And so I just want to make that statement and thank you. I know we're running short on time.
We are out of time. Representative Lesh, you get the last word.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Gieske, what are the consequences for one of your officers breaking the policy?
Chief Gieske.
Madam Chair, fortunately, we have never had an officer disciplined for not following the policy. Our officers are, I think, fairly well trained. It hasn't been an issue for us, so we've never actually disciplined an officer for not following this particular policy. There's been verbal coaching. There's been opportunities sometimes to review how to handle a particular case, but the actual formal discipline for violating the policy, we haven't dealt with that.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Chief Gieske, I assume there are consequences. Is that correct?
Chief Gieske.
Yes, there would be consequences. Again, it would depend on the nature of the policy violation, the totality of the circumstances, if it was intentional or unintentional, or if they could explain it reasonably where we were comfortable with that.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
Representative
can this committee get a copy of your policy?
Chief Gieske.
Madam Chair, absolutely.
All right. We look forward to getting that.
Thank you. And then
Representative Lesh,
two more
last
questions.
Okay, quickly.
Madam Chair, first, are your officers who wear body cams, are they all HIPAA certified?
Chief Gieske.
Madam Chair, I don't believe they are.
Okay, and then,
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, then I'd really be curious as to what the policy says regarding when they enter a hospital and what the implications are for the images they have, all of which images are protected by federal law under HIPAA. Then finally, just by way of final comment, Madam Chair,
Representative Lesh.
I think Representative Zerwas is absolutely right about whether the video of him shows, but we've also got situations where that's already happened. There was a member of this legislature who got a DWI several years ago, and the video of that, the dash cam video, was released to the news channel within 48 hours of that arrest before any procedures had even taken place, which I thought was embarrassing, and I didn't think it necessarily served any public purpose to do that. But we're still dealing with that on the other technology we have out there. I agree with Representative Zerwas and Representative Schoen on this point that some of that stuff's not necessary, but I look forward to a speedy resolution on this.
Thank you, members. You. We are in recess until 6 p.m. this evening. We reconvene the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. And the first item on our agenda this evening is House File 512. And Representative Norton is taking the chair, and we'll let her proceed. Thank you, everybody, for being here in the evening. Oh, and I would like to move House File 512. So House File 512 is before us. And Representative Norton, do you have any amendments?
I do, Madam Chair. I have the 0027 amendment.
Okay. I'll move the 0027 amendment to get it in the shape that the author would like. Any explanation on that, Representative Norton?
This is an amendment that came to us after some discussion with DHS, and it doesn't substantially change the bill, but it does make it more easily understood. So a lot of it was clarifying, and it went through the process and has everyone's support.
All right. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A0027, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Same sign for opposed. The amendment is adopted. Representative Norton, go ahead with your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 512 is one of a number of bills that you've probably heard about because I know you've seen several of them already, and there are a few yet to come. of bills that are before you because in May of 2012, Governor Dayton vetoed some proposed legislation on shared parenting that, and he told all of us it's a worthy topic for further discussion, but we need all of you to agree. And so go back to the table and work out your differences. And so to that end, we've been talking for over 2 years now in mediation. There's been a mediator that has flown in periodically to help us, and we've worked in groups, and we're working with the Office of Mediation here as well to try to see if we couldn't find a solution by keeping our discussion focused on the solutions that would support positive family transitions at a very difficult time in families' lives. And we were trying to keep the attention on the best interest and safety of children. And that was a priority for our group. So through many years now of mediated process, we have before you one component of that. And the component that we have before you today is when a family ends up in the court and asks a judge to help them decide on parenting time and child support, it changes those guidelines. And so I'm going to just walk through the sections really briefly, and then I think we have experts here in the area of family law who can dig through some of the details for those of you that are attorneys and may have a more practical and immediate personal touch with this, and I'm not going to be able to answer those questions. So in Section 1, and there have been some some changes with the amendment, so I may have to ask for help on either side here if I am speaking out of turn. But we're striking the presumption that the individual that has primary physical custody is no longer the obligor, and that is current law. In Section 2, we're defining obligor as the parent with the higher support obligation. It instructs the court to subtract the lower total support obligation from the obligor's support obligation. And this is, for those of you that work in law, you'll understand obligor and obligee. For those of you that don't, ask questions after, and the attorneys can help you with that. It also has a paragraph that discusses the split, when you have split custody, if there's more than one child at the time of divorce and the children are not equally with the parents and the custody is split, there's a way of talking about that and computing those obligations. And then Section 3, and this is in your overview as well, they did a nice job for you, provides that the presumption that percentage of parenting time means the percentage of time the child is scheduled to spend with the parent pursuant to a court order, and it can be rebutted by showing the parties have adhered to a substantially different parenting time schedule. And then the last one is the actual calculation formula, and I will just say we are still working through models of the calculation to make sure we have it right, and I think between now and the Health and Human Services Department, we're going to do some more runs on that, and we're working with the Department of Human Services to make sure we have it correct. But I think I'm going to leave it at that. This is this bill and the package of bills that you have been and will be seeing are, I just want to kind of lay out, there weren't any one person's perfect solution. This particular bill came to our discussion and subgroup because there seemed to be significant agreement between parents that some of us talked to, certainly within the court systems, that the current banding and talking of parenting time as a percentage was causing considerable angst at the top level when parents were arguing about what we call the cliff, and it isn't really a cliff, but it is the end of that parenting time percentage when there was a substantial financial implication with having more or less parenting time up around the 46 to 50% range. And a lot of arguing was going on right at that juncture. And so we're trying to level it out so that there isn't a fight over the parenting time as it relates to funding, but really hoping families will look at their own schedules and the needs of their children, and that the courts can help them to decide what's best for their child and themselves based on the actual time, the overnights, and that's how it's defined in this law, that they have and that they will spend with their child, rather than having that large cliff with a large financial incentive one way or another for the obligor or obligee. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to allow the testifiers with me to clarify all the mistakes I've made in describing this, and then we can all answer questions if you don't mind.
Representative Norton, would you just want to share with the committee and with the citizens that are here this evening where this model came from?
Oh, thank you. Yes, this is a model that came out of the state of Oregon, and I had an interesting email today from former Senator and Judge Tom Neville asking me that same question, and I told him that it came from Oregon. He said, oh, well, I wrote the original law, and we used Oregon as a model then, too. And so what that tells you is that the model that Oregon and we used years ago didn't work for Oregon very well either, and they have since changed their model. They've been through a number of years of bumps in the road, I think, and they reported to the groups, and I think there have been conference calls and education discussions with the Oregon folks, and they're very pleased, and I think feel that it's moved them from less fighting in court and easier transitions for families and children. So it is based on what is now the new Oregon model, and we're hoping to have a new Minnesota model as well.
Great. We'll turn it over to your testifiers now. Go ahead and state your name for the tape, and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Michael D. Ditburner. I am the legislative chair for the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. And I want to make some sort of general points about the bill. Mm-hmm. Ms. Sommerfeld, who is seated to Representative Norton's right, can speak to some specific points. But it is true that we're looking at taking from Oregon's experience and trying to apply it to Minnesota. It's been our belief that there has been a lot of needless litigation over parenting time based on a perception as to how that can impact on child support. Just to give you an example, think of the number of overnights that a parent may have with their child during a two-week period. There can be a significant difference in the amount of child support depending upon whether somebody has equal parenting time, 7 overnights during a 14-day period, or whether they have 6 overnights during a 14-day period. Hundreds of dollars, and that just doesn't make any sense, in our opinion. And while we think it was a good idea to adopt income shares about 10 years ago, we also believe that people should not be placed in a position where they are engaged in needless fights and have that emotional upset and anxiety over these issues. And we think that what Oregon did was a reasonable and fitting way of handling this problem. And so that's what this attempts to do. It attempts to replace these cliffs of parenting time. All the things being equal, you will have different amounts of support depending upon whether you have between 0 to 10% parenting time under our current statute, 10 to 45% parenting time, and 45% to 50% parenting time. What Oregon does is simply take a look at each individual overnight over a yearly period. And basically that creates a slope rather than a cliff, rather than these cliffs. And that's why we think you should do that. And also to get away from characterizing somebody as having primary physical custody as not being an obligor, that's also trying to get away from using labels in a way that create needless conflict. And so we think it's a progressive, it's a far-reaching, it's something that really, I think, protects parent-child relationships.
And so, Mr. Ditburner, how would that work for someone who's just got a new court order, just fresh off, there's really no track record for the number of overnights, actual overnights, it's just projected. So the child support then would be projected at least for the first year? Is that the way that would work? Or?
Madam Chair, yes, there is a way for people to try to figure out what the child support will be under the new law and perhaps to seek adjustments where appropriate.
Thank you. Did that conclude your testimony then?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape.
Well, my name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Family Law Section. I'm actually largely here to answer questions of a technical nature, but I will say that the Family Law Section is very supportive of this concept of moving to a less tiered version. We think it'll be better for people to have a slope because it will hopefully reduce some of the fighting that goes on at the cliff at the end, as everybody has talked about. I will say that, as Representative Norton mentioned, we are working with the county attorneys on an issue with the formula in here, and we will hopefully have that resolved before this gets to the next committee.
Questions from members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just describe briefly what the formula issue is, just in general terms?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
The formula issue, as I understand it, is in the first part of it, I think there was an error when it was put together in having the lower income, the lower obligation parent offsetting the higher obligation parent. And I think that will be changed to be more similar to what we do now and more directly related to Oregon, where you simply, we will simply be using the parenting expense adjustment rather than an additional tier of reduction.
Any other questions from members? Wow. Well, seeing none, I would like to refer the bill to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Oh, first of all, I need to ask if anyone from the public would like to come and testify on this bill. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. We're going to allow about 3 minutes per person on the public testimony.
Sounds good.
And could you please spell your last name for the record, please?
My name's Jason Smith, S-M-I-T-H.
Go ahead with your testimony. Perfect.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I appreciate the turnout from everybody here. On my way up here today, I was like, how did I get myself in this situation, driving up from Mankato in the snow to be sitting here talking in front of you? I suppose that is kind of what my father thought when he was sitting in the emergency room with a hook in his head from taking his kids out fishing one day. I'm here for the children. I'm with the Fathers' Rights Movement of Minnesota. We are a grassroots organization that focuses on shared parenting so a child can grow up and thrive after separation and divorce. We are the largest shared parenting organization in Minnesota. And we've also become one of the largest shared parenting groups in any state. This speaks volumes about the laws currently on the books here in Minnesota. We are the Fathers' Rights Movement of Minnesota. 44% of our support is women. It's stepmothers, mothers, grandmothers, sisters, aunts, cousins, you name it. Our goal originally was to change the current laws of Minnesota and allow children to be able to maximize their time with the parents. And in doing so, we realized we've also become the largest community support group for non-custodial parents in this. I think this bill, HF 512, is a good bill. It provides fairness in regards to child support. There are a few issues with it that I think should be addressed in the future. One of those is in area 313. The percentage of parenting time may be determined by calculating the number of overnights of the child court order to spend with that parent, average over a two-year period, or by using a method other than overnights if the parent has a significant time period on separate days. This is also included in the percent calculations as the header of overnights or overnight equivalents. And I think it must be addressed, what exactly is an overnight equivalent? I'll just share my story briefly. Over many years, I have ended up with 44% parenting time, never allowed to go above that, strictly because it would be a great loss of income for my child's mother. Not only do I have 44% parenting time based on overnight stays, I also take care of my daughter 4 days a week, June, July, and August. Add that up, 8 hours a day, it's 416 hours in a year and 17 days if you divide it by 24. That's a way to calculate it. But over the years, I have yet to find a judge that will see that time as a significant amount of time. It seems very easy to just add up what overnight stays are and figure it out from there. But I will say this bill is a huge bill. This is awesome. This provides fairness for every parent. And like they said before, that it will decrease the amount of arguing amongst parents of who gets what time, because it's fair. It's day for day support of that child. I appreciate you letting me be up here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason. Any questions from members? Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony, Jason. And safe travels back to Mankato if you're planning on heading back there tonight. Hi, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name and for the record. And if your last name isn't Smith or something that simple, please spell the last name for us.
Pretty simple. It's Jonathan Kerr, K-E-R-R.
Very good. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Thank you very much for the opportunity here. I've been asking for this type of a bill for several years now. I was divorced in 2008, shortly after this new statute came. I think it started in 2008. I think I'm the textbook example of what's wrong with the current law as it is today. To give you a little background on my situation, our parenting time is essentially equal. We share an equal number of days in a two-week period. Mom has Monday, Tuesday. I have Wednesday, Thursday. The kids go back Friday, Saturday, and Sunday between both homes, so that's completely equal. The only exception is that on my Sunday nights, they go back to Mom at 5 p.m. So what that did was essentially put me below that 45.1% parenting time. I'm sitting at 43.4% parenting time. So when this all came out, and of course this is all new, and you know, as you're getting divorced, you don't know what's going on. And the difference between, in my case, between being above 45.1% parenting time and being below 45% parenting time was I either paid $1,141 per month in child support or $81 per month in child support. It was a difference of almost $1,000 a month. So it's been that way ever since. And I mean, I got divorced when my children were 2 and 3. So it equates to about $200,000, you know, over the course of my children's lifetime. Just because I don't have my kids on, you know, 2 days a month, 2 Sundays a month from 5 p.m. to overnight. So I'm very happy that I see this, and I kind of echo my concerns about line 313 as well as the last gentleman did. In my case, I actually went to the Court of Appeals on this very line, and I basically asked the Court of Appeals to calculate it in another method other than overnight because I have significant parenting time on this Sunday, and it makes such a big difference. And the Court of Appeals said the word may is permissive, which allows the judge to do whatever they want to do with that entire sentence. And because there's a comma which explains, you know, it may be, the judge is basically given the opportunity. If they feel they want to calculate it that way, they can do some other method, but it's up to the judge. The word may is permissive. The word shall would be authoritative and say that you must consider that. So that would be my only complaint. But on the hindsight, you know, if you do this gradual slope, this really doesn't matter that much anymore. Because if we had this in place when my divorce took place, I mean, we would have been talking a difference of $81 a month or $150 a month, and we wouldn't have gone back to court. We've been to the Court of Appeals 3 times over our case. It's completely destroyed our relationship. It's just awful. So I really encourage you to pass this. And again, I've been asking for this for several years now, and I'm very happy to finally see this come forward.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Thank you so much for your testimony and for being here tonight. Appreciate it. Anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Rick Heller, speaking on Bill 512, unofficially representing the twice exceptional print disabled. I've always tried to understand this language in statute 518. And one of the things I seem to be missing in this language, I don't know, maybe somebody can explain that or perhaps have a later conversation as they continue to develop this, is how does daycare fit in this element when it comes to direct care? That's found on page 317. Obviously, on page, or lines starting on page 411, there's some sort of metrics there that perhaps describe what, not specifically, but what overnights are too. So
sure.
I basically, I know it's my understanding that when if parents get evaluated regarding who's the best parent, once again, that pins one parent against another. To review something based on the needs of the child, I think that's a real good thing, that you can rebut it. My experience with administrators is they have large discretion on what they do. So I welcome this discussion, as I've discussed before here, about the fairness for the child and the well-being and mental health for him as well. It's my understanding, historically, the legislature at one time mandated that they review the cases to see how many obligators were overpaying. And frankly, I think if you did a review on it, you'd find there's quite a few that don't understand their information. And that gets into the content accessibility laws, Guardian 16E. It's important to understand this information. Just like this proposed bill here, it's not a compliant with Minnesota Statute 16E. I thought it's important that you work on that as well. Anyhow, that's kind of off subject, but I commend the work that we work on, not to break down the family, it's already broken down, but to fill them up as much as possible. And thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Mr. Keller, thank you. I see we have a testifier coming back to the table that can answer the questions that you had, I think, about the daycare situation. Is that one of your questions, Mr. Keller, if I'm understanding correctly?
Yeah, there's a set different fee basis, I believe, that stands alone from child support. It's additional to the obligator or a parent. I'm not sure if anybody understands that, because since this is an oral discussion, I have a firm belief that a lot more people understand oral communication than written.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Zimmerfeld, and if you want to kind of share with the committee how that works, that would be great.
Yep. Well, nothing has changed in this bill from what we do now for calculation of child care support. Child care support is calculated based upon each parent's share of parental income for child support, which is a number that it's both parents' incomes added together, and then they divide it to see who has what percentage of that. And that is how child care expenses are divided. The calculator that we use now, and this calculator as well, would also it doesn't adjust it dollar for dollar as to what parent each parent should pay, because it accounts for who will be taking a tax exemption for the deduction for the child care expense. And that is not changing. This bill is not impacting existing law.
And Ms. Zimmerfeld, could you tell me, if a child goes to daycare, whose time does that account for? Is that the dad's time or the mom's time, or how is that determined?
Well, I don't know if it's looked at in that way. The child goes to daycare, I guess, based on when parents are working. If you have the child for parenting time during your day, conceivably you should be able to take care of the child.
Yep, right. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions from members?
All right, seeing none, thank you very much. If I
could just ask one question. If I yield.
Sure, Mr. Kelly.
So I understand it, when it comes to the presumption of physical custody or direct care, when you have a child in a daycare and a person's working, then that's considered they're in your direct care. Is that correct?
I'll let Ms. Summerfield answer that question.
Could you ask that again so I understand it clearly?
If I can maybe change it a little bit. The question is specifically, if the child is, quote, in direct care with the parent, and the child is placed in daycare during that time, is that time considered the direct care as relates to this bill?
Ms. Summerfield.
I don't know how that would, it would depend on the case, I would assume. If it's your parenting time, it's your parenting time, and if the child goes to child care, the child goes to child care, and the parties divide the cost. I think if you would be caring for the child during the day, that would be looked at on that case. But I don't know, if you're asking if that fits into a parent providing additional care for the overnight equivalents, if the parent isn't caring for the child and the child's in daycare, my assumption would be in most cases that would not apply.
Okay. So. Thank you very much.
So if I understand it correctly, is that the discretion of the judge, administrator, or who?
Ms. Summerfield.
How the child care portion works or the overnight equivalents?
I guess both.
The overnight equivalent discussion sections of the bill have not changed. They remain in here. The judge would have to determine if the parties were in fact having the judge make a decision as to child support rather than coming to an agreement themselves and submitting as a stipulation. The judge would have the discretion to determine if the requested period was in fact an overnight equivalent.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing no further testimony, I would like to recommend that we re-refer House Bill 512 to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is passed. Thank you so much, thank Representative you. Norton.
I have some administrative questions.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Okay. Representative Scott moves that House File 465 be re-referred to Public Safety and Crime Prevention. Representative Scott, it's your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since Representative Norton kind of covered the history of our group, I'll just kind of dig into what this bill actually does. Our custody dialogue group, as Representative Norton said, was divided into small groups this past year. I was part of the small group tasked with addressing the decades-old best interest factors. In our small group, we had a child psychologist, a family court referee, custody evaluators, a representative from legal aid, and a judge. All small group work products were presented to the large group where additional input was taken and changes were made to improve the work. A common thread of the many stories regarding people's frustration with family court was that the best interest factors seemed to cause a competition between the parents, with the better parent getting the prize of primary physical custody and the recipient of child support, sort of a winner-take-all scenario. Our goal was to revise this part of the law so that it was truly child-focused, where both parents are valued for their role in their children's lives, and realizing that the child relies on each parent in different ways. We also sought to change the focus of the factors from being based primarily on the past to a more prospective focus. It is a fact that the future for a child and his or her parents changes when they go from one household to two. Rather than base parenting time and custody on what has been, and this should be considered to an extent, it is essential to look at what lies ahead. I believe we have accomplished much, and these changes do consider the child first while also recognizing the value of each parent. We have strong language in regard to domestic violence, placing the child's safety as a top priority. I also want to point out that it is important to remember that these factors must be looked at as a whole, with care, not to isolate any one given factor.
And I just want to reiterate also what Representative Norton said, in that no one got 100% of what they wanted in this process. But I do believe that the changes that we've made on a global level are going to improve the lives of the families that are affected by the family court process. With that, I wanted to go over just the new best interest factors. And I was going to start on page 4 for that. Factor 1, a child's physical, emotional, cultural, spiritual, and other needs, and the effect of the proposed arrangements. Again, there's that prospective nature of the factor on the child's needs and developments. And again, I think I just wanted to point out here that this is prospective, and we wanted to make it, we wanted to make these factors usable and understandable to everyone that's involved in the court process. Number 2 is new language, and this is taken into consideration children with special needs. Maybe there's a child that is autistic, and they rely on one parent or the other to take them to certain appointments, or maybe with a child, it's not best in the best interest of the child at that moment for it to be going back and forth from one household to another. So we want to take into consideration any special needs that a child may have. On factor number 3, we expanded that. We wanted to make sure that the child, it wasn't just their preference, but there was more to it than that. We wanted to make sure that the child wasn't going to be able to be coaxed or coached into saying, yes, I want to be with mom, or yes, I want to be with dad. We wanted the child to have a level of maturity in addition to their age. Number 4, this is our this is the factor on domestic violence. We wanted to put the strongest language we could in there to protect the child. And it also addresses the household that the child will be living in. So it's not just domestic violence between the mom and the dad. It might be that the child may be living in an environment where the mother or the mother's boyfriend is there, and maybe there's been some issues there in the past. So we wanted to expand it from just saying that it's just the parents that may be facing the, or that may be dealing with the domestic violence. So number 5, I think, is self-explanatory. Any of the physical, mental, or chemical health issues of a parent, that affects the child's safety and developmental needs. This by no means means that just because a parent has a disability that they're unable to care for their child. If someone has a mental illness but they're on a regimen of, situation is a well-managed situation, then that certainly would not be putting the child's safety at risk. Number 6, I believe, is self-explanatory to the history and nature of each parent's participation in providing care for the child. We don't want to look entirely prospective. We want to and upset the child completely. We also need to take into consideration the history and nature of each parent's role up until that date. Number 7, the willingness and ability of each parent to provide ongoing care for the child, to meet the child's ongoing developmental, emotional, spiritual, and cultural needs, and to maintain consistency and follow through with parenting time. There's a real emphasis on that consistency with the parenting time and the track record of both parents, and be able to follow through with that. I think we've all seen the movies or heard scenarios of the child waiting by the front door with their suitcase, waiting for one parent to pick them up, and the parent doesn't show up. We don't want that to be happening on a consistent basis and subject the child to that. Number 8, the effect on the child's well-being and development of changes to homeschool and community. That's a little bit of a word change from what's in current statute. Number 9, the effect of the proposed changes on the ongoing relationships between the child and each parent, siblings, and other significant persons in the child's life. They may have step brothers or sisters that they're accustomed to being having a relationship, or the grandparents. those sorts of things. We want to take into consideration those strong relationships that the children already have. Number 10, the benefit of the child in maximizing parenting time with both parents and the detriment to the child in limiting parenting time with either parent. And again, we want to put the emphasis on the value of each parent and the value of the relationship that the child has with each of those parents. Of course, always taking all of these other factors into consideration as well. Number 11, accepting cases in which domestic abuse is described in number 4 above, the dispossession of each parent to support the child's relationship with the other parent and to encourage that relationship. And we've all been, if we haven't known people that have experienced the occasion when the two parents just can't build, is constantly tearing down the other parent and not being amenable to the parenting, a current parenting schedule, that's something that we don't want to have to subject the child to more than necessary. The 12th factor is we've added in the willingness and ability of parents to cooperate in the rearing of the child. We want to acknowledge that in most cases the parents do have the ability to do that, but sometimes they don't have the willingness. And so we want to make sure that that is a part of the equation. With that, I want to stop there and take any questions that members might have on the factors, and then I'd like to ask my testifiers to touch on any other parts of the bill that, or just to give comment to on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Question from members. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two things. One is I should have asked this question more generally about all these bills. Has the State Bar Association Family Law Section been a part of this process or taken any position on any of these, this package of bills? I should have asked this one of the earlier ones, but thank you. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Yes, they have. And in fact, that would be Ms. Sommerfeld, the representative from the Family Bar, from the Family Section of the Bar Association, is that right? And she's been along in this process the entire time, and this does have the rubber stamp. If you want that on the record, we could certainly bring her up.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No need, Representative Scott. And then the other question is, I guess I am concerned about the factor number 10 at 4.30 and 4.31, because it feels like the other factors all are kind of balanced, saying, you know, these are things for the court to consider that kind of could go one way or another. And it feels like that factor 10 is looking sort of solely at the benefit in one direction of maximizing parenting time, which certainly is a good thing. But one can imagine that in some situations there's a counter in terms of stability that would be good for the child, that sort of thing. And so I guess I'm wondering if you can give some background for that factor in particular, because it feels like it's kind of more leaning one direction as opposed to being more balanced like the other ones.
Scott. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have Mr. Dipbrenner answer that question.
Mr. Dipbrenner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the sense of our...
And I'm sorry, Mr. Dipbrenner, I know you already introduced yourself for the last hearing. However, this is a new hearing, so can you just reintroduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Michael Dipbrenner, and I am the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, is also a group of family law attorneys that practice family law in Minnesota. With regard to these factors, we took a lot of consideration in coming up with these factors, and we thought long and hard about what factor 10 should look like. And it really was our sense that there is a separate statute, 518.175, subdivision, I believe it's 5, that talks about situations in which it may be appropriate to restrict parenting time. And so there's already that statute balancing things out. And there's also other factors here that look at unique circumstances affecting a child that may look at something different than a maximization of parenting time. And so we thought that that was a much better way, much more sensitive and appropriate, sophisticated way of handling the situation than having a factor say, well, the benefit to the child of limiting time with the parent. So it was our belief that it was really unnecessary to switch that factor around to do it like that. I mean, there are people on this group that were both supporters of a presumption in favor of joint physical custody and were opposed to having a presumption in favor of joint physical custody. And so the fact that we were able to come together
on these factors the way that they're written, I think, was quite an achievement.
Thank you. And Representative Scott, I see no other questions from the committee, so did you want to proceed to your next portion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to see if either one of the testifiers here had any comments regarding anything else that went into the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Hugdahl, any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. We've also been working with Representative Scott and the members of the dialogue group throughout the last two and a, almost half years of this process. I think I would largely echo what Representative Scott and Mr. Ditbrenner have already said. I think the section following the factors, just so folks know, much of it is existing law that we just put into a numbered system. There are kind of some hanging paragraphs. We added a few things in there that were kind of more public policy-ish statements. We didn't want them to be factors. And the other thing is that I would add, I think, about the factors themselves is we did a lot of discussion about making these factors usable and for families and courts and evaluators. And we had a person, a child psychologist, who kept saying, we talk about an ADA, and she would say, well, what am I supposed to do with that? So we really wanted to make these much more usable than current law, and so that people understand what they are. I think that's been a barrier for families, is understanding what the existing factors mean and how a judge got from point A to point B, from their pleadings to their order, especially with a large number of unrepresented parents we have in Minnesota coming through family court. That was one big goal that we have been talking about for quite some time on this section of the statute. So I think think those are some very good steps that this bill takes forward. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Any questions for members from Ms. Hugdahl? Seeing none, then thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Mr. Ditbrenner, any comments to the bill?
Nothing further.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Scott?
I just wanted to add, before we ask for testimony from the public, that As Mr. Ditbrenner alluded to, this dialogue group was made up of people that were for and against a presumption. And in fact, when I had House Bill 322, he was my biggest opponent. So
I don't get any.
Okay, and the second. Okay. But it's been a really interesting collaborative process, and one that was not easy, but has been very rewarding, and feel like we really have it. And even from the testimony on Representative Norton's bill already, that it's going to make some positive differences for people. So with that, I guess it would be just okay to have the testifiers in public.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And before we go to public testimonies, I would note that I've been impressed with this process. I feel lucky that I haven't had to take part in it, honestly. But I, as well as many other people around here, I remember 10 years ago and the fight over income shares. What it left was a wasteland of bruised feelings and scorched earth, I think, from a lot of people, and a reluctance on the part of many legislators to wade into that. But you and Representative Norton's bill before you, then also Representative Lane and Representative Mahoney up there, who have been working on this collaboratively with you all, and having that mediator fly in has really impressed me, because when this process started out, I was skeptical. I honestly didn't think you guys would arrive at this point. So having hearings like this bill and the bill before it, some of the newer legislators have no idea how nice it is to have a hearing like this compared to what it was 10 years ago. So thank you for doing this as well as all your collaborators, those that are here and not here. With that, are there any members of the audience who wish to be heard on this House File 465? Please come down and take a seat at the testifier's table and introduce yourself for the record prior to beginning your testimony.
Hello, my name is Mike Downey. This bill doesn't affect me personally. I've been married 45 years. But my daughter has gone through a divorce, and so I'm here trying to represent her interests, but also our grandchildren's interests. Statute 518.17 has been used in the past, and this is a great improvement. I support the bill. But there's a question on point number three that no one has been able to answer to my daughter's satisfaction or my wife's and my satisfaction. And I just wondered if I could take the opportunity to ask Representative Scott or anyone from the working group, is there some intention or some thoughts behind the words "is of a sufficient age and maturity to express an independent and reliable preference"? I'm an engineer, so I have an overdeveloped left brain. I like explicit language. And this is as general of a statement as I could come up with. When I see those words, I don't know what it means. Is there a rule or something or some directive of what that means to a family, of a divorced family, and to the children? I know of children or grandchildren that are 10 years old that could make that determination. I know some that could, are 11 or 12 that could make that determination. But how is that determination determined in relation to when they're able to make a decision on their own with the judge?
Ms. Hogdahl, do you want to take this one?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the factor under current law, it simply says the reasonable preference of the child if the court deems the child to be of sufficient age to express a preference. And one of the things we talked a lot about was talking about that there should be more than that, because there's no really magic age. Kids are individual. There are some kids who are a little younger who are very mature. There are some kids who are a little older who are not mature.
Mostly boys.
So we really talked a lot about in our group about how to frame that to give the courts better direction, because I think there are a lot of us who really are uncomfortable with kids who are too young either being asked that position when they really aren't mature enough to have a preference, and that it's independent, and also the position to where parents feel that there's maybe now a magical age where then the child can weigh in. I mean, there is a practical reality that children, I think a lot of us who've worked in family law or have been through this process know that children reach a certain age when they're teenagers, and as somebody knows, used to say, they vote with their feet. And so we want those kids, a lot of kids over the years, who have, some of whom come to this committee, have talked about how they felt a lot of stress about how they were teenagers, their voices weren't adequately heard. So we wanted to be respectful of that, but we wanted to do it in a way that wasn't just about age. So we added the phrasing about sufficient maturity and independent, reliable preference. So we want that to move forward as judges look at it. We think this will be a lot better direction to courts and evaluators as they're going through this process, and that was the intent.
Thank you, Ms. Hogdahl. Mr. Downey, does that answer your question?
It does a very good job. I know some states have 12 as an age, but I understand the need to determine the situation on an individual basis. But mm-hmm. Will there be any guidelines to the judicial system and judges?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I haven't added here regarding our group is that there's going to be a small group of us moving forward. I'm not part of that at this point, but it's called the Cultural Change Group. And they are going to be responsible for kind of educating anyone that works in the family court, the judiciary, that sort of thing. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like yet, but that's our phase three of this process, so that the courts, you know, this is going to be a lot for the courts to digest,
yes.
A lot of changes, and so we want to help them to develop that new culture.
Thank you again, and it answers my question, and I again support the bill, and thank the working group for all the work they've done over the last 2.5 years.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. Are there any other members of the audience who would wish to be heard on House File 465? If there are, please come down. And Mr. Downey, did you sign? Okay, we're getting good. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Laura Dyer, and I'm here as both a concerned parent and the neighbor of a little girl who was murdered during parenting time in my neighborhood in Mack Groveland in 2004. I'm very grateful. This is a good start.
HF 465 in considering child safety as a factor for their best interest. Also, I have some concerns that domestic violence doesn't end with marriage dissolution. And the needless, protracted litigation is often caused by that factor. I think Minnesota can lead the way in protecting children and keeping lives free of abuse, both during and after marriage dissolution. And I'm hoping that domestic violence experts can be part of safety evaluations for children whose parents are leaving situations of abuse, and that they will be welcome to testify in Minnesota courts. I'm also hoping we can extend legal aid funding for people leaving situations of domestic violence who have perhaps been prevented from pursuing a career and having their own financial resources. There is currently no funding for post-degree litigation. A good study regarding all these factors is the 2012 Saunders Report to the University. It's from the University of Michigan. It's a national report, and it's a very detailed study. And that is all.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Dyer.
Is there a place for citizens to suggest solutions regarding best interests of children and the...
Well, Ms. Dyer, you're here now. So, and that's not a joke, seriously, those suggestions are welcome with your individual legislator as well as to the committee here. So any additional ideas that you'd want to offer, this is an excellent forum for them. But if you want to offer them in a different or less formal setting, you can certainly approach your own legislator too. And if they're not receptive, another one.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I might also add that on our small group that we had in this custody dialogue group, we did have members from a group that represented members of the public on these issues. So it wasn't that it was all just a bunch of people from family court. It was also citizens had a voice there as well.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Representative
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first year of our group, yes, we had MCBW. Is that the right acronym? Yeah. That's the Battered Women's Coalition. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to note for the testifier that I represent part of the McAllister-Groveland neighborhood, and so may represent her, and I prosecute domestic violence outside of this job, so I'd be happy to talk with her afterwards as well. Just wanted to note that.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Any other members of the audience who would like to be heard on House File 465 today? Seeing none, then we do have one other. Please, sir, take a seat. You've already introduced yourself for the last hearing, but please do so again. And make your statement for the record.
Sure. My name is Jason Smith. I'm with the Fathers' Rights Movement in Minnesota. Most important issue that we take on is for our children, the children of Minnesota and across the nation. Parental alienation and denying parenting time is child abuse. For example, children from father-deprived homes are more likely to have academic issues, early sexual relationships, increase in teen suicide, and a higher rate of committing abuse, just to name a few. Shared parenting reduces family conflict. However, the current custody laws support conflict, and some in the family law profession use this for their financial benefit. We realize historically that it has been the father that must argue the right to parent, normally, especially unmarried parents, where the mother is presumed to have full legal and physical custody. However, we have become a place for all non-consortial family members to speak and seek and help and guidance. With regards to HF 465, line number 1.13 and 3.10. It's the deletion of the best wishes of the party or parties as to custody. We ask you, the lawmakers, to continue to recognize and respect and protect the fundamental rights of parents to be able to parent even after separation or divorce. without governmental control, so long as it does not fall under the child abuse or neglect. Will you continue to do this?
Were you addressing that to a specific individual, Mr. Smith?
Just in general.
Okay. Well, Mr. Dittbrenner, did you want to take that? I see you coming up here.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with regard to the issue of the deletion of the factor that's known as the wishes of the parties, we took a hard look at that, and we looked at what experiences were under current law. This came from the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, that language, which Minnesota was just a handful of states that adopted that. And what we found was that that wasn't really meaningfully being used by courts in analyzing the best interests of the child. Courts were basically saying, well, this parent wants this type of custody arrangement. That parent wants that kind of custody arrangement. And that was the limit of the analysis that was being conducted using that factor. And so what we thought was, what could we do to make it more meaningful in terms of enhancing parent-child relationships? And so you'll see that there are certain factors in here that really do take into consideration what wishes are, such as on line 4.23, the willingness of each parent to provide ongoing care for the child. Line 4.28, factor 9, the effect of the proposed arrangements. It's parties that are proposing certain types of arrangements. And so in that, the wishes of the parties are going to be given consideration. Also, too, if you look at, in terms of promoting parent-child relationships, in lines 518 or 511 through 513 on page 5, taking a look at considering that it's in the best interest of the child to promote the child's healthy growth and development through safe, stable, nurturing relationships between a child and both parents. And line 514 to 5.16, the court shall consider both parents of having the capacity to develop and sustain nurturing relationships with their children, unless there are substantial reasons to believe otherwise. So really, you know, I believe fundamentally that parents have a constitutional right to the care and custody of their children. And judges in this state are under an oath to honor that constitutional right. And so what we decided to do here was not to eliminate what people want to do, but to have a more sophisticated analysis that judges are going to give greater credence to. And I think that we've accomplished that.
Thank you, Mr. Dittbrenner. Does that answer your question, Mr. Smith?
It sure does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have further comments? Or
yes, please, if okay. I could.
Go ahead, Mr. Smith.
In line number 4.30, number 10, the benefit to the child of maximizing parenting time with both parents and the detriment to the child in limiting parenting time with either parent. We support this bill. It is in the child's best interest and is supported by numerous studies and research over the last 20 years. In 2014 here, 110 of the top psychologists and social science experts concluded this. It was written specifically for the issue of shared parenting as it relates to lawmakers. And we'd be happy to provide each and every one of you a copy of this. Line number 4.32.11, except in cases in which domestic abuse, as described in Clause 1, has occurred, the disposition of each parent and support the child's relationship with the other parent and to encourage and permit frequent and continuing contact between the children, the child, and the other parent, and the willingness and ability of parents to cooperate in the rearing of a child. We understand divorce and separation is a difficult time for any person, especially parents. Domestic abuse equally affects men and women and is a horrible act, and we are doing all we can to help eliminate this from our society. Shared parenting helps to eliminate this. Children from homes where both parents are involved are less likely to commit abuse. So it is imperative to stop abuse before it even starts. And divorce and separation causes conflict, especially with the addition of conflict-driven family law attorneys. However, it must be recognized that studies show that the benefit of shared custody on a child's well-being exists independent of parental conflict in both low and high conflict situations. We also just want to make note, so you are aware of this, that order for protections are sometimes a necessary tool to help protect victims of domestic abuse. However, they're also used within the family law as the golden ticket to win custody. Even when an order for protection is dropped and found unfounded, the fact that there was one still issued comes into play in custody proceedings, and some lawyers encourage this practice. Line 5.12, number 2, the court shall consider that it is in the best interest of the child to promote the child's healthy growth and development through safe, stable, and nurturing relationships between the child and both parents. Again, this is supported by numerous studies and research done within the last 15 years. From a social and psychological standpoint, it is ultimately in the child's best interest to have equal access to both parents. And in fact, in a recent study of adults that came from divorce homes, they in fact wanted more access to that non-custodial parent. In 5.14, line 5.14, the court shall consider both parents as having the capacity to develop and sustain nurturing relationships with their children unless there are substantial reasons to believe otherwise. In asserting whether parents are capable of sustaining nurturing relationships with their children, the court shall recognize that there are many ways that parents can respond to a child's needs with sensitivity and provide the child love and guidance. And these may differ between parents and among cultures. Our thought on this is that this is the paramount argument for an overall increase in shared parenting. I'll be honest, I'll never do everything right as a parent. And my daughter's mother will never do everything right as a parent. You as parents probably already know this as you've gone through life. And you know there's no guidebook. We all learn as we go. From other parents, including our own. However, that increase in shared parenting does, and what it does is it provides a balance in that child's life. Neither parent will be a perfect parent, but with shared parenting, there is a balance so that the child will grow and thrive in their life. Like I said, we support this bill. It's a good bill. It's not exactly what we want. We were not involved in the child custody dialogue group, no matter how many times we asked to be. We want more, but we understand this is a good first step in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Smith. Please make sure you sign in.
Will do.
Are there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 465? Okay, I see Mr. Heller raising his hand. Just so I can see a show of hands, anyone? Okay, one, two, I see two other people besides Mr. Heller who want to be heard on this. So, Mr. Heller, what I'm going to do here is limit you to 3 minutes on this. Do you want to testify or do you not want to testify? Come on up here and testify. Make sure you sign in. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony, Mr. Heller.
Rick Heller, thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 465. Unofficially representing the variable learners. You'll find that in perhaps Statute 120B.15A, Subdivision 2. Called the twice exceptional, a lingual word. Anyhow, one of the things I have a question about this bill in front of us on line 522, if someone, I'll come back to it, but it says something about some sort of statute about disability alone, and it says 363A.03. I'm not quite sure. If I look at the content on the summary, it doesn't tell me what line that represents on page 3. Be helpful in the future when they do sections like this on this summaries that they show you what lines they're talking about.
to understand the content, because if it's a summary of complex statutes, it's probably above the current plain language or text difficulty. It would be important to help the audience understand that better. So that's one of the questions. Again, 363A.03, I'm not quite sure if that has to do with the Department of Human Rights. One of the elements I believe is missing, frankly, or could be improved upon, perhaps, is social. Social-emotional directly affect special ed, and especially the twice exceptional. They're extra sensitive to that. Social is also interaction with their peers in school. That's another element they use with positive intervention plans, not just academic. So it's two parts in the education system. I'm not quite sure if that's relevant to this, as well as giftedness. I guess social emotional probably would fall under, they got emotion in there, I think, under 410.10 through 15. The other element to this is, how does giftedness fit in this element? If we're really looking at the whole person, and that's about ability to how you process information, and many kids perhaps might be, for instance, age 6, but they're actually age 20, based on their ability of processing information. So based on the whole child, not just perhaps what they know, which is achievement, but based on how they process information, might be better for the for improving this. That's a suggestion I have.
Did you have comments, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to add in line 4.12, any special medical, mental health, or education needs that a child may have that may require special parenting arrangements. So we've really tried to look at the whole child in this and what we're trying to do, but I appreciate a suggestion for sure.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller.
If I may ask the chair one more thing, what is that disability loan on 36A.03? I'd like to know the content of that. It helps kind of understands what's going on there regarding why that one singled out called a loan.
Ms. Mullen.
Sure. Chair and representatives and Mr. Keller, the definition of disability under the Minnesota Human Rights Act is listed on the bill summary. It's on page 3, number 4, and that's physical, sensory, and mental impairments, and that's it's a broad definition that the statute uses.
Mr. Heller, sensory would probably fit the bill for your area. Is that accurate?
Actually, there's state identifies fourteen types of disabilities.
I meant, Mr. Heller, just for the purposes of the bill, but.
For the purpose of the bill, does sensory meet that? It would be interesting, perhaps on February 25th, when we start the discussion on those individuals, we'll perhaps get to the meaning of that. One other thing, if I may add.
Go ahead, Mr. Heller.
It's my understanding that one lady that was testified earlier here had asked, what are some of the processes for people providing input? It's my understanding that the legislature can provide funding, as some state departments, and I don't, obviously this is probably not a state department, but it could be, they can allow funding to have to write rules. They have public input. I believe the administration judges get involved in that as well. So if anybody wants to clarify that, that might be helpful for the audience to know as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Heller. Thank you for your testimony. Make sure you sign in, Mr. Heller. Next person who wants to testify, please come on down and introduce yourself for the record.
But you can check the record afterwards. Good evening, Chair of the Committee and members. My name is Troy Bonkowski. He is in Bonkowski. I'm also with the Minnesota Fathers Rights Movement. I became active last summer. I've been divorced 5 years. And if I could.
Well, if you could what, Mr. Bonkowski? One second. Mr. Bonkowski?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I have 3 children.
Did you want that passed out, Mr. Bonkowski, and just passed around the committee?
Yeah.
Sure, that's fine. The page will pass it around the committee. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Bonkowski.
we were talking about presumption of shared parenting, and that is necessary. And to have the divorce attorneys oppose it doesn't come as any surprise, because what we're talking about is equality between men and women, fathers and mothers. And to do otherwise is sexist and discriminatory. There is no legitimate statute that should say that a woman or a mother should have more parenting time than fathers. But that's what this group has proposed. And it's not fair. I've had judges tell me it's not fair. And so I think as a movement we're here to express that opinion, because for far too long we've been quieted and silenced. And you know, the legal issues, we have been shut out of this process. We've been trying since last summer to be involved, and each time we were told it's a closed group and that they're not hearing testimony from families. And it's been an ongoing issue. It's not fair, and the bar members have been have had their representation on this task force. I'd say proportionally they've been most of the members, and say what their best interests are for the children that are affected. It's their job, and they're there to make money. And you know, I've had judges. I've had a special needs child, and I've had teachers say that he's not progressing in school. And they gave me hints on how to help him. And I wrote a letter to the judge expressing this. And her court clerk and her, Judge Ann Offerman, Scott County, they called me and they laughed at me. They've laughed at me in court. They've called me on the phone, laughed at me. I've had Judge Perkins out of Carver County laugh at me when I express my frustration and my desire to be with my children. And the judges have told me that she can do whatever she wants. And when I talked, you know, when I first came to divorce, and I said, why are the children in daycare so much? I mean, I can watch them. And, you know, not only would it save me money, but spend time with my kids. And I was told I was a consideration. Not a father, I was a consideration. And that's the way I've been treated by the courts and the statutes that exist. I've been accused of child abuse. And, you know, the county came out, I talked to them, and they said that there was no evidence, and then their investigation was going to end. But then she showed up at the hearing unannounced. I was given no notice, and she said that she believed the mom. And I had to tell the judge there's no evidence of this. And, you know, the statute, and the judge ruled in my favor, but the statutes are that they can keep bringing that up again. And so she hired a divorce attorney, and last summer her divorce attorney brought the allegations up again. I said, it's already been proven in court that they're not true. And the judge said, well, that's her right to do so. And I think that's the way fathers are treated. And you know, I understand that people, you know, want to move forward and in increments, but I don't think that this bill is making a huge step towards equality. We need a presumption of 50-50. And it breaks my heart. I mean, I have three kids, and Every time I had him, I brought him to church. I had him enrolled in Sunday school. They loved it. Mom got remarried to an atheist, and now they don't go to church. And since the allegations, I haven't had custody again. And when I did hire an attorney and got custody back, that's when she hired an attorney, and they had a hearing that I was not given notice to, and so I wasn't present, and my custody rights were taken away. This happens far too often. And, you know, I'd ask the committee that seriously consider giving shared parenting the presumption and equal rights for all.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bonkowski. We'll ask, and please make sure, Mr. Bonkowski, you sign in on the page that you've testified here today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Shannon Burns. I am here representing Minnesota Fathers for Kids and the United States Fathers' Rights Movement. And we are greatly in support of these efforts from the group and this bill. But there are just a couple of things that I wanted to note, specifically with regard to line 4.23, the willingness and ability of each parent to provide ongoing care for the child, to meet the child's ongoing developmental, emotional, spiritual, and cultural needs, and to maintain consistency and follow through with parenting time. I am a stepmother and expectant mother for the first time, and it has been 513 days since I've seen my stepson. We have active parenting time orders in effect, and despite all efforts to get relief from the courts and to exercise those parenting time court orders, unfortunately, the other party continues to withhold the child, and we are provided no relief from the courts, only told to continue to try and work it out. So my point is that line 4.23, I'm very happy to see that this is included, because I think it's very important that both parents are, and it's a factor that both parents are willing to continue to exercise parenting time, and that I know that there's been other language in some other bills that discusses penalties for parents who withhold parenting time from the other parent and ultimately the child. So I just wanted to thank you again for your efforts and reiterate that we are very supportive of this bill. Again, it's not 100% everything that we would love to have, but we believe that, you know, we're moving in the right direction, and there are a lot of very positive efforts that have been made with this group of bills by the group. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Burns. I don't believe there are any other members of the audience who wish to be heard on House File 465. So, Representative Scott, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks again for being here this evening for this hearing, and I just want to say again that nobody got 100% of what they wanted, and we really do feel like these changes are going to make some real positive movements in family law and improve the lives of kids in Minnesota and the relationships with each of their parents when the parents are fit and able to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 465 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Scott. There being no further business before the committee is adjourned.